You know what this is like? It's like those old movies we both love.
Now I'm gonna tell you my whole plan, and then I'm gonna come up with some absurd and convoluted way to kill you, and you'll find an equally convoluted way to escape.
Sounds good to me.
Well, this ain't that kind of movie.
Hello, and welcome to another movie podcast. My name is Oscar, and with me is...
Ralph.
And
Luke.
That's right. Coming from our separate homes, not too far away. Today's episode is number 101st. And what we'll be doing is something kind of special. Since we fucked up, but we in general fucked up. And instead of making something special for the 100th episode, not that we're like care about anniversaries or anything like that, but still kind of an occasion.
We do.
We decided to, you know, do the 100th like a regular show and then just put it off for this one. So the special thing we're doing is that each of us chose a film, one of our favorite films of all time, and we're just going to review those movies. And it'll be like personal and interesting, and they're going to be good movies. And those movies are going to be Pulp Fiction, which Ralph chose, Chasing Amy, which Luke chose, and then I chose There Will Be Blood. So yeah. You can find out our website over at otherpodcast.com. Over there, you have a lot of other movies, including past, more recent Quentin Tarantino reviews on there. Not to mention no Kevin Smith reviews, which is funny. But, you know.
Really?
Sure we can fix that.
Not even so. A new? Not even one of the newer ones?
What newer ones? We didn't review Yoga Horses, did we?
I don't know. That's what I was asking. Tusk was the other podcast, right?
I don't think
I could have sworn we talked about Yoga Horses at one point.
I think we talked about it.
Maybe in a recent Discoveries. But I just don't remember. But maybe you're right, guys. Maybe you're right. I just don't remember. It doesn't come to my mind immediately. I know we did one Paul Thomas Anderson movie, the last one, The Phantom Thread, I think, for a bonus.
I didn't do Phantom Thread. I haven't seen it yet, but probably somebody did.
Yeah. Anyway, I think I did it with Lexi, maybe.
No, you did it with me, I think, because I saw it with you.
You saw it with me? Okay.
Yes.
Cool. That was well.
Because
well,
I know she helped me on a lot of bonuses, and I wasn't sure who did what.
Yeah, no, I remember she did also, but I can't remember.
Yeah. Anyway, check all that out at otherpodcast.com. Not to mention, besides bonuses, we have our top 10 shows on there, which we have now quite a bit. We have like over 10 on there over the past few years of different sorts and variety. So check that out. You can also send feedback of any questions you mind on any show we do over at podmoviecast@gmail.com. Everything we have here is located on your show notes for every show you download. Now, I want to talk a little bit of what you guys have been up to. Ralph, how's been the last 2 weeks since we talked to you about? How you been?
I'm pretty good. Not so bad. I've been slowly but surely spending a lot of money. That Trump refund, or that Trump stimulus, should I say.
Oh, you got
my
it.
Apologies. Nice. Yeah, I got
going
this.
To something special?
Did it go to something special?
Is it going to, or did it already?
No. I paid off a credit card that I owed. So that's done and paid for. And then I put most of it in savings, actually, just to recuperate some stuff that I had a car issues. So I kind of paid myself back for those car issues.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and then they totally upgraded my PC. So slowly but surely, I've been doing it. What did I do? Spent like graphics card. That was on my own, actually. But it is what it is. then I got a SSD, a new keyboard. I don't know. A lot of shit. I feel like I spent a lot of money, and I can't tell you on what.
Yeah. You felt like you did, you just don't know exactly what?
Yeah. Okay. But at the same time, I'm like, I have money saved, which is the smart thing to do, but I just feel like I should have more. I've also made a lot more Costco runs. I feel like a total dad right now.
Likewise.
Oh, my God. I've gone to Costco probably like once a week, which for no reason. I usually go to Costco once a month. But I can tell, obviously, we're just eating more at home, stuff at like in – instead of going out, I still eat out. Don't get me wrong. Yeah, of course. But I do feel like I've been at home more, and we go through more things because I'm here a lot more than I normally am. So I'll go through more of my beverages. So I have to go out for that. My son goes through more of that stuff as well. Snacks. There's got to be snacks in the house. Things of that nature. But I've been trying to avoid it, and also just going for random stuff like buying a friend the TV and such like that.
Yeah.
So, okay. Yeah, other than that, I mean, I'm still at work. I'm on 10 days off, 4 days on. So that's pretty cool. Not in conjuncture. They're kind of mixed up. 1 day on, 3 days off, 4 days, 3 days on, 7 days off. But it's still like in a two in a pay period, I have 10 days off and I work 4 days, which isn't bad. I mean, I'm not complaining. I still get my full hours, so that's pretty cool.
Yeah, I mean, I'm in a similar kind of boat with Starbucks. Obviously, not to the extent that you are, but still, I mean, I'm not working at all. Right. But we're returning. My store's returning on May 4th. So next show.
May the 4th?
Yeah,
May the 4th be with you.
Which I believe is a Monday. It's my first day back. And they're only open until 3 or 4 or something like that.
That's good.
So I'm working like 11 a.m. or something like that. And I'm still, I'm going to get paid extra for the time that's, you know, because that's only like 20 hours if it's 5 days at the rate that is. And then I'll be getting paid the rest of it. Still as a catastrophe pay or whatever they call it. So I'm good luck there too as well. Luke.
Yeah.
Yes.
What you been up to? What's going on?
I'm on vacation, kind of, because I'm using less annual time than I need to. So I'm taking advantage of that.
Hmm.
So I'll be off for like 20 some days. It's pretty amazing so far.
Any plans?
Lucky no, not really. Just playing a lot more Call of Duty with Ralph most of the time.
Get that duty. Get those victories.
Spending a lot more money on stuff, obviously.
Yeah.
Like everyone else. Trying to stimulate the economy.
Yes, that's true. Any pipe dreams that you want to fulfill? Like any that one game or that one series or that one thing, you know?
Two things right now. It's Final Fantasy VII Remake, and I want to finally finish off Big Bang Theory Season 12.
Is that the last one?
It is the last one. Yeah.
Fuck.
Right.
Talk about, you know, staying too far beyond its welcome. I stopped watching at Season 8 or 9, and I was like, I'm done. But I didn't know they kept going so far. Damn.
Yep. Season 12 was the last one.
All right. Well, that show printed money, you know, just printed.
Oh, of course. But I liked it.
Yeah.
And no, I'm invested in it. So I need to find out how it ends.
Yeah. All right. And, I have nothing. I already said my little piece, but essentially what I've been doing is I've been doing, just off handily, I'll just say, I'm in my scene two, no, three, I guess, technically, the third scene of, short story stop motion animated movie I'm making in my own room, and it's like I wrote a whole story and an outline and shot list, and I'm doing all that. Editing is a bitch and a half.
Yeah, that's pretty dope. I remember you told me you were doing that.
Yeah, it's super. I'm using a lot of like trinkets and toys to make up lore and science to it in a magical realm. It's about the alternate realities. It's like a whole thing, and I'm gonna have
can't wait to see it.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know when it'll be
so done. Slow motion porn.
That's what I thought too. That's the first thing.
Yeah, baby.
And I have I'm just gonna mention this one element of it, and that's that I have several. I have four total Funko Pops, and two of them are Tracer from Overwatch, Widow from Overwatch, Widowmaker, and Symmetra. And I have those, and those are the main characters. And I have a smaller version of a fuller size Funko Pop of Tracer. And I'm using the smaller one as the main hero. And then when she gets buffed up, I'll just replace her with the bigger one. So I'm going to have this whole thing with these pops and making a movie out of them. So yeah, it's the whole thing.
All right.
That's really all I've been doing, give or take. So we're going to continue on here for our recent discoveries. And we each have a little bit. I have four. Ralph, I think, has one. Luke has two or three.
Yeah, so let's start with me. Okay, I'm a call an audible on you there. I have the one. Let's just get me out of the way. Besides, mine falls in with Luke. So my movie that I saw is I'm such a horrible person. I should have IMDb.
Parasite
is
IMDb the movie.
IMDb the movie. Yeah. No, it's Parasite. I know, right?
Yeah.
It's okay. Bong Joon-ho. Yeah, that's what I wanted to get everybody's name. I didn't want to say anybody's name wrong.
Yeah.
This, according to IMDb, a comedy drama thriller, if you want to look at it in that aspect. There's a lot of shit going on in this movie. I can see why everybody raved and wanted this movie to win. And I know a lot of people are just wanted people to watch it. I mean, this movie's fucking fantastic. I loved just about every second of it. The characters are so interesting and they feel so like recognizable, but at the same time super unrecognizable, you know? And then, I don't know, the movie, like, I think you brought this up when you did a mini reviewer of the movie when you saw it, Oscar, but it's the director, Bong Joon-ho, does a great job of translating, what's it called, moving into genres, if you were to say, make something very nice into something very dark. And then vice versa. It's kind of comedy also in that dark moment. Or comical. But yeah, it was a hell of a movie. And I ended up seeing this with Luke. So Luke, what did you think of the movie?
Yeah, I thought it was a fantastic movie. Finally see what the big hoopla was about it, I guess. Yeah. But it was good. Acting was like top notch. I loved the story. And I loved the family and how witty they had to become to get everything under control and their situation. And how, even though they were like brand new to the situation, they're like, how could I get my like family involved in this and profit from this or kind of benefit from this?
Yeah.
It's like almost like five movies scrunched together in a way, because they all could be their own plots if they wanted. To see if, like, you can see a three-act structure of getting just her family working for that rich family, right? And you can see a three-act structure of what happens after that, and you know, but it's all one movie, though. It's all little elements of a bigger scope or whatever. I have a question for both of you. Now that you've seen The Infamous Parasite, would it have made your top 10?
Of that year, yeah.
100%. Probably. Oh, yeah, definitely.
Well, I would have made my top 5 easily. There's no way. I mean, I'll... It's just a really good movie.
I hate that feeling though when you see a movie after, like,
that's unreal. It's like the worst, one of the worst feelings, especially so recent. I'm good at not watching stuff, and like, I know anybody can say that, but like, I'm really good at not watching stuff.
Yep.
As in, like, hey, did you see this one here? Nope. And I'm never gonna see The Green Book. I'm not gonna lie. I'm just never gonna see it.
I'm missing out.
But so I know.
I want to see it.
Okay, go watch it on your own. Anyways, but. As I was saying, is like the big winners or whatever, I'll just be like, yeah, it doesn't interest me. I'll watch it like 10 years from now when I don't feel bad anymore for not picking it or for, you know what I'm saying? Like, maybe not 10 years, but like at least a couple of years later where I won't feel bad for not watching it. Or some movies just don't interest me either. Some movies, the subject or whatever, I'm just like, I'm not into it right now. I'll watch it later. It's not a big deal.
Yeah. So that's your one, Ralph. Parasite, finally. Thank God you watched it. I'm glad you loved it.
You should have watched it with us. It would have been a great viewing with you. I would have seen you squeal like a little schoolgirl.
I would have probably ruined it. It might be better now to watch it as a second time. It would be my third. But
we should show it to my wife. She saw some of it, and she was like, what the fuck is going on in this movie? It's bonkers. And I was like, it is.
Yeah, it is. Parasite might break into the once-a-year movie I watch. I have like 12 or 13 of those that I watch every year, no matter what. A lot of them tend to be action movies because that's my go-to relaxing movie.
Yeah.
But some of them are not, you know, some of them are, you know, like There Will Be Blood, for example, is the one we're discussing in this today's episode. That's like once a year movie, you know. Parasite might meet that criteria. So we'll see as time goes on. But Luke, you have other movies you saw. So why don't you talk about those?
Yes. One movie is actually one that you showed me back when I think it came out. But we only saw like the first 10 minutes of it. And that was it. And I was like, fuck, I need to see this movie, see what happens. And that was The Final Girls.
I showed you the first 10 minutes of this movie?
Yes.
Wow.
I don't know. But we started watching it. And then and we had to leave.
I remember we were, it was one of those rare times, Luke, when you were hanging out in my room, which is really rare. No one's ever in my room. And you were hanging out with me and I was just starting to watch this movie. I don't know why you came over. Maybe you're waiting for Ralph or maybe you were picking up food. I don't know, cause you live close by. And, but you were there and then you left after I had started it, cause I was watching it for the first time. I've only seen it once. And then you left. I think that's what it was. I think you saw it with me in my computer.
Probably, yeah. But hey, finally got a chance to see it. And so I loved it because you actually used a clip of that on the last show.
Yeah, I use it I have an intro and an outro bumper right. That I used. Yeah.
But yeah, it's like a comedy slasher film, which is kind of funny because it's kind of what we watched last time. One Cut of the Dead, comedy slash type movie. But yeah, it's a fun movie. It's
movie interests me now that you said comedy slasher.
Right. It's pretty much, I don't want to spoil it for you, Ralph.
Yeah, no.
I'm on IMDb right now.
Don't spoil yourself.
Don't read the synopsis real quick.
No.
No.
Oh wow.
Okay. But it's pretty much.
It's got that one guy from Workaholics, right, or whatever.
Yes, and it also has the guy from Silicon Valley.
Is he in Silicon
Valley? The main dude. I don't remember his name.
There's another guy from Silicon Valley.
Oh, Thomas Middleditch, you mean?
Yes.
Yes, that dude.
Well, pretty much
The movie's meta about slashers, essentially. And it's really interesting
how. Ooh, meta slashers? I'm in.
It's really interesting.
Yeah, it was a fun watch. I do recommend watching it.
Stop reading stuff.
Now, either of you two have seen the remake of The Town That Dreaded Sundown? By any chance?
Why does that sound familiar? I know I've seen the original.
It's a classic 70s movie, I think, or maybe 80s.
Oh, then I probably didn't see it.
It's with the
that's the original.
This is the one that comes out in the end, right? They come outside, like, so a bunch of whatever.
It's a killer that at sundown starts killing people, essentially. And there's, like, a weird meta component in the original movie where it relates to the news outlet that's around the movie. I'm trying to remember. It's been so long. But they made another one, like a remake or a reboot or something, or a sequel. And I thought it was going to be bullshit, obviously, but I watched it anyway. And it turned out to be way better. They took a meta component out of that original and added this whole new element and angle to it. And I was going to say, if you had seen it, it would be, it's like similar in the same feeling that Final Girls is.
I have not.
But if you haven't seen it, then it's okay. But check that out too, guys. The Town That Dreaded Sundown. It's good.
Maybe.
Yeah. Anything else, Luke, you have?
Yes. I saw
Mudo.
2018's Mute, which is directed by Duncan Jones.
Yeah,
my man Duncan.
Who did Moon. He did Moon, Warcraft, Source Code.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You mean the amazing Warcraft?
Right.
And the amazing Source Code?
Right. Well, I finally got a chance to see Mute. I actually didn't know this movie existed until a coworker told me about it.
This is a 35 on Metacritic. Jesus.
It's not that great. It's definitely got issues.
Yeah.
But I feel like this movie is like, you could take like Blade Runner, and this is something that could happen in like the Blade Runner universe, and it would fit in perfectly.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it stars Alexander Skarsgård, who is like this, obviously mute.
Skarsgård.
Right. They're like, I don't know, they're like Amish. And so he can't get the surgery to fix his voice. Also stars Paul Rudd, who plays a complete dick in this movie, which is like the best selling point. Like, I've never seen Paul Rudd be a dick. And there he is in this movie, a complete dick. I would recommend it just on that.
It's such a rarity for you. I didn't know.
Right.
It was on your bucket list to see Paul Rudd acting a dick.
Because when I saw Paul Rudd, I'm like, oh, he's probably going to be a good guy. And, you know, at first he appears to be. And then I'm like, holy shit, this guy sucks. Love it.
It's all about the little things, isn't it?
It is. It is. It's a Netflix movie worth checking out. If you got the time to kill.
Right. All right. But you still enjoyed it, right? It seems like you did.
Right. I mean, obviously there's some glaring like pacing issues, and I'm just like, come on, speed up, you know, type of situation. But aside from that, it's all right.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I think that's it for you, right? You have those three, right?
Yes.
All right. I have a bunch here. Let's see. Let's start with Jane, Silent Bob Reboot.
Oh, yeah. And what do you think of this movie? This is rough.
The synopsis is, Jane Silent Bob returned to Hollywood to stop a reboot of the Blunt Man and Chronic movie from getting made. Written and directed, of course, by Kevin Smith, a thinner version of Kevin Smith that we all grew up with. And those jokes are very much in the movie as well. And it stars, him and Jason Mewes and a bunch of other people, which includes, actually, Fred Armisen, Ben Affleck, Joey Lauren Adams, which is a classic from Chasing Amy. So a few Chasing Amy stuff in there. Basically, if you are a Kevin Smith fan or have been or grew up with his films like all the three of us have, especially with me, it's Dogma, Chasing Amy, and the Clerks movies. Those are the ones I saw the most, at least repeatedly. Then you could have some enjoyment of this movie. And this movie, though, is awful, but I still enjoyed it. It's an awful movie. But I very much enjoyed it because it played exactly to the things that only I would understand as a Kevin Smith enthusiast. And since I, saw all his movies in the 90s, even Jersey Girl, even all of them, doesn't matter. I've seen them all. And but I can't. It's really hard to defend this movie because the jokes are even worse. I mean, the jokes are still like in the set into like the 90s, but even in the 90s, they were bad.
That's the same problem we and you had, wasn't it, Luke?
I believe so.
Yeah,
it's so awful and so like strangely like look at the camera, Jimmy in the camera, like, hey, you get it, huh? And and it got annoying. The first one was already cringeworthy, but they added like 10 more, and I was like, fuck, bro. I'm like, but that's the style it's going for. I just wish that style was sought after by people, and it's not. It's just we're way past that point. And me too, never. Even watching his older movies, I kind of delve into that, like the original Jay and Silent Bob Strikes Back, or some of his more outlandish comedies, like Mallrats, for example. When they do that, it's still like nowadays, it still feels a little, so that's dated as fuck. But, it's still Kevin Smith. I still grew up with him. I still love those older movies. But right. This new movie, can't get behind it as much, even though I did enjoy it. Especially later on in the movie. Basically, once they get to Chronicon, I enjoyed it a lot more.
They
brought in a lot of more... more elements from other movies, and they did a lot of callbacks. They were just more enjoyable for me, so I was able to like enjoy it on that level, and I got better once they got there. And I do not think that Kevin Smith kid can act very well, but she does her best though. She's not as bad as Joey Hooker.
I love that joke they put into the movie, how he's always trying to get his like kid into movies.
Yes, they had tons of jokes like that, tons of them. And then, the strange Iron Man, like, connection in there. I'm like, what the hell is going on in this movie?
Yeah, I like that. Yeah. I also like the references to his other movies, The Dogma with Matt Damon, where he's been.
Oh, yeah.
That was great.
Did you think they just called Matt Damon? They're like, hey, do you live nearby a church?
Can I just think, I think what happened was that, Kevin Smith had, like, was it a heart attack or something? He had something going on in his life a couple years ago, and he lost a shit ton of weight. He's a vegan now and a bunch of stuff like that. And anyways, after that happened, he's like reassessed life or whatever bullshit, obviously changes, stuff. But because of that, I guess he called in all his favors and he just made this movie, got this movie made because like there's all these guys are gigantic actors,
getting Ben Affleck famous.
In getting Ben Affleck. Yeah, of course. Yeah. Chasing Amy and Alone.
Yeah. I mean, right. Chasing Amy Alone. And, he was, I mean, you know how every director has every upcoming kind of director that's famous for something or whatever has that one star they bring up with them. You know, there's always a few of those, or sometimes a famous actor hooks up with a one-time director and it makes that director famous, or the other way goes around. Kevin Smith and Ben Affleck made each other, careers in several ways. So in the 90s, so that makes sense. I get that. That's the Jay and Silent Bob reboot, and I saw it on Amazon Prime. If anyone's curious, if you have Prime account, it's on there. The next movie I have here, I saw a Netflix movie that looked interesting. I'm surprised I even never heard of it. Came out 4 years ago, I think. 2017. It's called The Assignment. Has anyone heard of it?
Probably not.
No. Written and directed by Walter Hill. After waking up and discovering that he has undergone gender reassignment surgery, an assassin seeks to find the doctor responsible. And this movie, that sounds strange, right? And this movie stars Michelle Rodriguez as the man assassin being forced to be a woman by surgical reassignment. By the villain of the movie, which is Sigourney Weaver, the bright, super like smart doctor that does that to her. And this also stars Tony Shalhoub, who I haven't seen in a while, and Anthony LaPaglia and shit like that. And it's for an action movie, it's decent. It's not like doesn't have any like standout action scenes, but it's solid. It's like you can tell what's going on. It doesn't
on Netflix.
Doesn't cut weird or anything like that. What?
What's
yeah?
Is this on Netflix?
Yeah, it is.
That's what I thought. I saw this before somewhere. I read it or something. Yeah. No. I saw the trailer for it on Netflix, and I was like, "What the hell?"
She's supposed Netflix to be a dude. Was pushing it on my timeline, and that's
same thing with my timeline. Yeah.
Right. So I don't know if they just got it, and then
which is weird because my wife is like. Screwed up my Netflix timeline. It's horrible.
You gotta get her own account.
I already have Max. I already have four Max accounts.
Start one, cutting off the dead weight.
One account is being used by like three people, so.
Some put her on that one.
I should.
Yeah, you should put her with my, I assume you mean my
No, she'll never, like, she'll just be like, what do you mean? I don't know what you're talking about. I only know that there's kids and the one that's yours.
Yeah,
right, of course.
Anyway, The Assignment, a pretty interesting movie. It looks like, you know, when I was watching it, it looked like it came from some graphic novel or something, because sometimes they would do this strange, like, animation, like, silhouette after a certain scene. And I'm like, okay, does that mean this is based on something? And I didn't know. But I never heard of it anyway. And Michelle Rodriguez is pretty solid. You know, I'm just saying, you know, I know she has a lot of ups and downs. Like, half her movies are really good and half her other movies are pretty schlocky and bad. This one fits in the really good category. And using the nature of the whole thing, like this, you know, butch man of a man assassin, you know, being confronted and forced into the opposite, like this world of gender reversal, is an interesting element to this action movie. And I've never seen that before, and it should be lauded in some way. I mean, I've never seen it. I'm sure it exists somewhere, but it's my first time. And I thought that the movie introduced that stuff pretty interestingly and pretty cool. And so, yeah, if you're interested in seeing an interesting or different kind of action movie, watch The Assignment on Netflix. Again, I enjoyed it. It wasn't like amazing, though. The plot's pretty much, you can know what's going on. There's some weird elements with interviews and flashbacks that I think works half the time and not the other half. But besides those things, it's still a good movie. So that's The Assignment. On my way here, I saw the Shit Has Fallen series.
What the fuck?
Yeah, what is that?
Yeah, that's Olympus Has Fallen, London Has Fallen,
oh,
and Angel Has Fallen.
You're funny. You're so funny. Ha, ha, ha.
I was kind of hoping you didn't get it. I worked. Okay. Yeah, I saw all three movies. Obviously, I've seen Olympus Has Fallen. We reviewed it, Raf, for the Twin Films Marathon we did late last year. So I saw that again. Still holds up. And I saw, for the first time, because when I was watching them, I don't remember them, London and Angel. And I got to say, they're fun movies. I like this trilogy. I'm so down with this, only this Gerard Butler property. Only this one. I mean, I can't think of another
one. Does he have other ones?
I mean, I know he has other movies and other stuff, but I don't remember liking any of those. I mean, I have to go back, I guess, but maybe he was a co-star in some movie I liked, but either way, he's not like the lead. But yeah, these are solid movies. I like them. The insanity of the action. Everyone's against America in so many ways.
So many. Even America's against America.
Right. That's like the plot of the third one in a way.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's ridiculous, but it's like it plays it on a level of like serious, but not overly serious. That just kind of works for me. And this in the whole trilogy, they kind of strike this tone that I just enjoy watching. And I would say, though, and the real thing, though, the first two movies, Olympus and London, I think has the better action sequences. I wouldn't even say almost by far, but like a noticeable difference. And the third one, they do have some solid stuff for sure. It's not like it's bad or they got lazy. I just didn't think they didn't get too ambitious, as ambitious as they did with the other two movies.
Yeah, I agree with you. I actually like London Has Fallen for the action. It's pretty cool. And it's like,
yeah, they have that one Steadicam
stuff, makes sense. Yeah, I know what scene you're talking about.
Yeah, the great Steadicam long shot is really cool.
Yeah, I think the biggest action scene in this one is the beginning. Is the best, should I say, or one of the best.
On the lake or whatever?
What? No, the beginning. Wait. When he's just doing the training mission.
Oh, I see. Yeah, yeah. Okay, yeah. That was pretty good too. Yeah.
Yeah. That's the most memorable one for me. I kind of already forgot the movie. I'm trying to think. I remember explosives. Other than that,
explosives in an action movie? Get out of town.
Yeah.
Get out of town.
Well, a lot of explosives from like old man. Anyways, yeah.
All right. Yeah, anyway, I don't have a lot to say. They're just fun action movies. They did not disappoint. I could see them again in the future. That's all I got on it. And they're solid stuff. You know, we are all action movie fans here. So it should be accounted here. Last but not least, I have a strange movie, a documentary. So, Luke, your ears are perking
up. Ooh. What do you got?
It's called Hunt for the Skinwalker. Came out in 2018. And it's a documentary about the most intensive scientific study of a UFO and paranormal hotspot in human history. That hotspot being Skinwalker Ranch, as it's commonly known now, which is a ranch located in the northeastern area of Utah. and Uinta Basin, right next to the Ute tribal land area. I mean, it's kind of almost like a selling point to something else. This is a research. I watched this movie for research for the other show that I do, the SOS show. And because we're doing a two-part series on the Skinwalker Ranch and all the crazy shit that's been going on, I've spent, I don't know, 20-plus hours researching over the last 2 weeks. And I've been finding stories. So I watched the movie to see what kind of stories I could get from there, because it's based on a book, but I just didn't have time to read the book. And I wanted to see what's on there, and I can, like, research from here, you know, when they give out names and testimonies and stuff. And a lot of great stuff on there. And it's not just UFOs, guys. This Skinwalker Ranch thing, you know, that displays, it tells of a land that is rife with, like, things like dire wolves, strange cattle mutilations, like Bigfoot sightings, supposedly. That's, like, lesser. Portals, orbs of light, spacecraft, of course. So many things goes on in this fucking area that now residents who live there have had, you know, generations of seeing this stuff. You know, the peak of the sightings were actually the 60s and 70s. And people wonder, and people think it's a hotbed today still.
Does it coincide with the LSD usage being high in those times?
I was about to say the same fucking thing.
Probably. I know, I read a lot of stuff from the 70s and news articles about sightings and stuff. I read a lot of that stuff.
Because the government totally fucked with people with LSD and shit.
Yeah, they did. Yes, they did. I even went into, on the last show that we did on the research for this place, the government was involved in making a program called ATIP. That's the acronym anyway. And in about Skinwalker and all the areas there. And they found some interesting stuff for sure. You know, some strange stuff that are unexplainable to this day. And so many different kinds of things, too. They have almost everything. Anything you can throw at. They have poltergeist activity there, too. They have a lot of ghost sightings. Everything. So, like, this is a paranormal insanity zone, and the documentary is out there with pretty prominent people that I read about, like George Knapp, who comes from L.A., pretty big coast-to-coast radio guy. He, you know, who wrote the book and did the movie, was interviewed a bunch of times. So if you're interested in that kind of thing, check it out. The documentary itself is more sensationally, like, it's trying to sell you as well as inform you. So if you're interested in that kind of documentary storytelling, then you might like it. But however, though, it does, because it's sensational, it kind of comes off as a little, like, little kooky. You know, okay. How people can see.
Yeah.
You know, the type of documentary that tries to sell you on their topic and it makes them look less official. So I think that this movie has that problem because it does, like, play with the editing and stuff like that to, like, sensationalize their points. But when you sit down and watch for the fucking testimony or you watch their footage that they're bringing to you, it's cool. You know, that's cool. So, yeah, just got to get through all that mud. But, yeah, the movie's pretty good. It's not, like, the best, but it's pretty good. Hunt for a Skinwalker, you can rent it. So that's how I got it. So check it out.
Where did you rent it through?
Oh, iTunes.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, so, and that's all I got for you guys today. That's it for our recent discoveries. We're going to take a little break. And what are we doing first? That's right. We're doing Roth's Choice first. So we're going to come back and review probably the biggest movie of all time, at least in 30 years. Pulp Fiction, give or take. Not really. I mean, I know Avatar made a lot of money too, but Pulp Fiction, pretty famous. Check it out. Stay with us.
You ever seen that show, Cops? I was watching it one time, and there was this cop on. He was talking about this gunfight he had in the hallway with this guy, right? And he just unloaded on this guy, and nothing happened. He didn't hit nothing. Okay, it was just him and this guy. I mean, you know, it's freaky, but it happens.
Look, you want to play blind man, go walk with the shepherd. But me, my eyes are wide fucking open.
What the fuck does that mean?
I mean, that's it for me. From here on in, you can consider my ass retired.
Jesus Christ.
Don't blaspheme.
God damn it,
I said don't do that.
Hey, you know, why you fucking freaking out on us?
Look, I'm telling Marcellus today. I'm through.
Well, why don't you tell him at the same time why?
Don't worry, I will.
Yeah, and I'll bet you $10,000 he laughs his ass off.
I don't give a damn if he does.
Marvin, what do you make of all this?
Man, I don't even have an opinion.
Well, you gotta have an opinion. I mean, do you think that God came down from heaven and stopped?
What the fuck's happening?
Oh man, I shot Marvin in the face.
Why the fuck did you do that?
Well, I didn't mean to do it. It was an accident.
Oh man, I seen some crazy ass shit in my time, but this...
Chill out, man. I told you it was an accident. You probably went over a bump or something.
Hey, the car ain't hit no motherfucking bump.
Hey, look, man, I didn't mean to shoot the son of a bitch. The gun went off. I don't know why.
Well, look at this fucking mess, man. We're on a city street in broad daylight here.
Believe it, man.
Well, believe it now, motherfucker. We gotta get this car off the road. You know, cops tend to know this shit like you're driving
just
a car pissed in fucking blood.
Just take it to a friendly place, that's all.
This is the valley, Vincent. Marcellus ain't got no friendly place in the valley.
But you'll save my fucking town, man!
Shit!
The lives of two mob hitmen, a boxer, a gangster and his wife, and a pair of diner bandits intertwine in four tales of violence and redemption. It's not a bad synopsis, right? That's what I'm saying. This is Pulp Fiction.
It's vague enough. Sorry.
Yeah. It's vague enough, yeah. This is Quentin Tarantino's Pulp Fiction, starring John Travolta, Uma Thurman, Samuel L. Jackson, a shit ton of other people, Tim Roth, Amanda Plummer, Phil Lamar, Eric Stoltz. Eric Stoltz is a good one. Steve Buscemi.
He's in it for one scene.
He's in there.
Yeah, I guess. I guess he's technically in Miller's Crossing, too. Just one scene.
Don't blame the guy for being in movies.
He's Miller at the crossing.
There's no Miller.
Christopher Walken's in this.
It's like History of the World Part 1 or something.
Right. Kathy Griffin's in this. Do you remember that? Kathy Griffin being in this?
I do. She's the one who tells Marcellus Wallace about the crash.
Dwayne Whitaker and Peter Green, Maynard and Zed. Got to talk about those two guys. That being said, Pulp Fiction, obviously, it's my choice. This is a fucking favorite. Used to be almost a really bad movie of mine. Not bad movie. A really, almost a hated movie of mine, actually, if I go by that route. Because I've seen it, I don't know, so many times. I don't even know the number, to be
brutal. That was on me. You know how, you know.
No, it was on you. There's a couple movies. This one, The Usual Suspects.
Mission Impossible, I saw.
Mission Impossible, yeah. I figured out another one. There's another
Mask,
movie also.
The Mask, when we were younger than that.
Yeah, The Mask wasn't that bad because I think I still had fun watching that movie because I was still young.
Yeah, we were kids. We saw The Mask and Home Alone 3,000 times.
Oh, yeah, but Home Alone I can still watch, whatever.
Yeah, those are good movies, classics.
Adventures in
Babysitting. So is this movie, fuck you. Adventures in Babysitting, yeah, I remember. So that being said, like I said, talking about this one for Pulp Fiction, I've seen it so many times and then I just didn't understand a lot of it. I was like, I was a kid. And I've saw it so many times. I can quote the motherfucking movie. What I liked about it is just the amount of swearing that was in this movie.
Yeah, right.
And the randomness of it. And then watching as an adult or growing up with the movie, because I totally saw it as growing up also. And then now rewatching it, I love this movie. This movie's fucking fantastic. Yeah, I mean, I can't get into it. Like I said, this is the first time I've ever read the synopsis of the movie on IMDb.
Yeah.
Even though I've seen the movie, I don't know, fucking double digits, close to triple for sure. I mean, it's fucking somewhere up there. I don't know.
For me, I won't be surprised if it is triple digits.
I mean, it's just like I can quote most of this movie. It's unreal. Like I was quoting.
I can do the entire movie probably.
I get certain things wrong because I know I've changed things as I go along. But I mean, yeah. I'm like mouthing the words as he's saying it right before he's saying it. Right. Everybody, it's just every line, male, female, who gives a fuck? Like fucking,
right.
Even the dog barks in the background. Jesus Christ!
So there's a motherfucker coming up.
Yeah, there's a motherfucker. Right,
a lot of motherfuckers.
There's a lot of those.
I think this movie still
sure.
holds that record for the most use of the word "fuck."
It could be. You can tell.
We'll find
out. You can tell Quentin just kind of muted himself. You can tell that. What's it called? Samuel. What's it called? Quentin Tarantino just told Samuel L. Jackson, "Just go at it."
No, I won't be surprised if every single motherfucker was in the script either, though.
You know what? Yeah, 100%. I would agree with it. Like, it's just like
cut it down. I'm like, are you sure you want me to say this? Like, yeah, say it.
He probably was like, motherfucker, there's a lot of motherfuckers in this.
Right.
I wouldn't be surprised. Yeah. And he's just so good at saying, like, he's just good at swearing.
Yeah.
I mean, like, I know he owns the word. That word is motherfucker for 100%. He owns that word. Like, there's no one who
can
say
it. The plane was built just around his ability to say that.
I would 100%. Yes, that's true.
So, yeah, of course. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. What was the number?
So, while it is the one most motherfuck is Jackie Brown with 37.
Oh, wow.
Still Quentin Tarantino.
Pulp Fiction is 26.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's not bad.
That's pretty good. Wow. Okay.
You're right. Like I said, that being said, it's just cool to intertwine these stories, these tales. They all mesh in like a manner of like 2 days, I think, story wise or whatever. And then it brings up a lot of like things, like what happens if John Travolta didn't do this, or what happens if Samuel Jackson doesn't do this, and
yes,
who dies, who doesn't, this isn't that, and. It's just a super cool movie. The dialogue is amazing, and it just keeps you captivated at all times, even though the movie is long, 2.5 hours.
Or 3 hours.
According to IMDb, 2.5 hours.
Like, and for a movie that's, I'm not saying it's about nothing, but it feels like it's just about people hanging out. It doesn't feel like it has like a grand thing.
No, it does. But at the same time, I think it's just, it's things about like what your actions what you get for doing with your actions, you know, what you reap, what you sow, and shit like that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it's tales.
There's a lot of stuff going on, but it's also like just seeing people day in the life of these people's lives, but at the same time, like, this is like the worst possible scenario in one of their days, like,
yeah,
for sure, for Ving Rhames and what's it called? I can't think of his name.
Vincent.
Say Vincent. Bruce Willis. Yeah. No, Ving Rhames and Bruce Willis, like, that's like their worst day. Like, they're their worst day ever in life. Like, it's just there's nothing tops that day.
Yeah. Them.
Yeah, so, like, stuff like that, you know, and same thing goes for, what's it called, Samuel L. Jackson and John Travolta, Vincent Vegas and Jules Winfield. They have their own, like, pretty shitty day also. But, yeah, it's a super cool movie. What do you think, Oscar, I know what you think, so fuck you. What do you think, Luke?
I think it's a great movie. It's one of the first movies Oscar showed me back when we had VHSs, and he would have all his VHSs queued up to his favorite scene in a movie. That's how weird Oscar was.
Yeah. That was me.
Yep.
I used to put all those, you know, when you have two tracks, you could connect. They have that double cassette player, right? And you could copy something from one scene onto like a blank tape. I would do that with my favorite scenes on a bunch of VHSs and have it in one tape, and I would play that. Yeah, that's how insane it was about it. That's how many times I've seen all these movies.
Looks like that's how weird Oscar is.
Yeah.
That's funny.
That's something that I did, yeah.
Maybe. Yeah.
Sorry, you were saying, Luke?
Yes, that's, I think, my first introduction to Pulp Fiction, and ever since then, it's just been one of those movies that, I think it was like one of my first Netflix rentals with like DVDs.
Oh, really?
My God, yeah. Back when Netflix would ship you movies.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, still doing it, I think, right?
I think it's like...
No, I think it's called something else. It's DVD.com or something.
Oh, okay.
I think it's owned by Netflix, but yeah, I think they still do something. Also, such an iconic poster.
Super
iconic. It is, yeah. I've seen that thing artwork all over. I mean, a lot of things like... Like Simpsons have still stolen from Pulp Fiction, and other things have stolen from Pulp Fiction. It's it's
pretty itchy and scratchy. Huh.
Yeah. You might be thinking, oh, yeah, maybe it was. I was thinking Reservoir Dogs, itchy and scratchy, but you're right. I think they did a Pulp Fiction one, too.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. They do Reservoir Dogs, yeah.
Yeah.
With the ear, yeah, I remember.
Luke, before I go on, because I have a thing.
What else? The movie is obviously held in high regard by all three of us.
Mm.
We all think it's a great movie. I'm sure it's all being applauded as such by film critics and whatnot.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, especially in the 90s when it came out. I mean, this movie inspired so many copycats, right? So many copycats came out of the 90s and early 2000s, and in some ways still. You know, it inspired so much. Obviously, it inspired a lot of bad movies too, because copycats tend to, you know, be lesser than this one. But some of them are pretty good, you know. Anyway, so I tried what I wanted to do for this my 300th rewatch of this movie and my first time really reviewing it on this level was to try to find something or try to see if I could notice something that I had never noticed before. And I did. I noticed something about the movie as an essential movie in American cinema or world cinema. And that is that this movie is like the Fonz. It's the Fonz of movies. What's Fonz like? He's cool. I think this movie is the coolest movie that Americans ever made. And obviously that comes from the opinion of me watching it as an early young you know, inspirational being in the 90s. So, like, you know, probably goes with a grain of salt a little bit. But when you think of the coolest movies, you think of The Big Lebowski, you think of things like that, right? And I think
very
Pulp,
much so.
Pulp Fiction is that movie for me and for a shit ton of people, and why QT, Tarantino, has so much clout to this day when making his stuff. And don't get me wrong, all his movies have very similar qualities in and around these kind of things. But Pulp Fiction is unique because it's not about any one huge thing. It's an assortment. It's almost like it's four stories told in one sitting. And, you know, the way it's told the stories and stuff, and you just want to sit down with them. No matter how, what bad shit they do, no matter what their beliefs or politics are or what bullshit they have, no matter how agnostic they are, whatever, it doesn't matter how many people they kill, you constantly can't help yourself but, like, enjoy their presence. And I think it makes you feel cool looking at them being cool. And I think that's what this movie has. As the cool factor is number 11. It's like ranked up to 11. And then the rest of it is very good too. Very good writing, very good acting, very good everything. But the cool factor is what makes this movie like legendary. And that's what I noticed coming off about 4 days ago when I watched it again. And but beyond that, like, the movie does great care. Like, the way it shifts the stories is, it's perfect. I mean, I've heard people complain about how it is unnecessary, and then you could tell the same story if you do it in chronological order, like a regular movie, right? But it wouldn't make as much sense. The way they introduce characters, the way they introduce Bruce Willis with Marcellus Wallace, isn't during the Bruce Willis short story. It is right after the opening when Vincent and Jules comes back with their, you know, volleyball shirts wearing things, you know, after their crazy day that you don't know about yet. You know, they come over and you introduce him to this long monologue of this gangster talking to Bruce Willis to take, you know, to take a fall in the fight. And you know, that kind of introduction lets us understand exactly when Bruce Willis' story starts, at the time, the wristwatch, whatever it's called, the watch, when you get the flashback of him as a kid being talked about his father and the Viet Cong and this guy having... That story is amazing. That story is what the movie is about. The movie starts off super serious. This kid's about to be talked by a colonel that saw his father die, and he's going to give him a watch that his father promised, you know, he promised his father to keep for him to return. And he's telling this story about all his great-grandfathers surviving the wars and shit. And then it gets to a hilarious point where he's still being serious. He's talking about this watch being up his own ass for 2 years and up his own father's ass.
I thought it was 5 years. Oh.
5 years, yeah. His father does 5 years. And then his own ass, 2 years, and he hands it over to him. He hands him over an anal watch, essentially, and and it's hilarious.
It's up my ass.
Is that like the porn version of Overwatch?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And that movie, that feeling, and that one little monologue that Christopher Walken has in that scene is exactly what the whole movie is. Like, it starts off, you know, oh my gosh, this bitch is ODing on me, and they're going crazy. And then the way they're yelling at each other makes it funnier and funnier. And as you get along, and they finally stab her through the fucking thing with the adrenaline shot, and then gets up and fucking flails around. Everything seems to be, like, safe. Everyone's breathing easy now, and you're breathing easy with them. And then the fucking wife, Eric Stoltz's wife, is like, that was fucking trippy because she has, like, 1,000 piercings. And to her, that adrenaline shot is the ultimate piercing. And I just like a funny punchline to every single scene like that. And it works really well. It just really, really works. And I consider this movie more of a comedy than like a crime movie or like a drama, because I think everything is set up for like deliveries and punchlines, but in a way that feels more natural, I guess. I don't know. It's really good. I love this movie. Obviously, I should go without saying we're spoiling this movie right from the beginning.
Oh, I mean, 94, of course.
Yeah. Also, if Tarantino hadn't switched the stories around, the timelines of them, then the movie would have ended with John Travolta dying in that kitchen. The way this movie ends, it ends with him and Jules leaving the cafe, like, having done their business, you know what I mean? Going, continuing
right,
the day.
Right.
You know, it's a different feeling, even though you know he's going to die the next day. It don't matter. Now, obviously, Jules is... What is it? His.
But it also explains why. Where's Jules in that scene?
Right.
Why isn't he with them if they're partners, you know, and stuff like that?
Right. Yeah. I mean, no, Bruce Willis wouldn't have survived.
No, Bruce Willis wouldn't have survived, right. You know. So, yeah, that's. It's an important scene in the movie, even though the movie does a really great job to make you forget that that scene's coming up until you're at that diner again. And then if you've never seen it except for the first time, you're watching it and you're like, is this a diner? And then you hear Garcon coughing. You're like, oh, shit, this is a diner.
It's about to go down.
It's about to go down. Yeah. That's right. So, yeah. I mean, it's such a cool, it's so well made. I mean, it's just, and intertwined stories are just fantastic. Everything's connected somehow, somewhere.
Yeah, it's almost like a hyperlink movie. You know how hyperlink movies were like all the rage in the early 2000s?
Yeah.
You know, movies like Babel, right? In a way, Cloud Atlas.
Oh, yeah, Babel. All
right, Babel, yeah, that's probably the worser. Oh, no, the worser one is that one Best Picture. Oh, what's it called? Crash.
Crash.
I remember you hated that movie.
I still hated that movie.
Hates that movie.
I know I like stuff in it, but I didn't like it overall. I love it overall. So like, you know, I'm like, come on, this movie, come on. But yeah, that has that hyperlink feeling, but they feel so close knit. It's a big LA, but it feels like they're all like in four spaces. You know, it doesn't feel like it's one giant world that they're living in. You know what I mean? Because you're so with the characters all the time in Pulp Fiction that it feels more intimate than a hyperlink movie, you know? At least I feel anyway. But I spoke a lot about it, so you guys can carry on whatever you guys want to say.
I mean, really, I don't know what else to say about it, really. I mean, it's such a... I mean, I can ask the questions, I guess, that I asked Luke, which was, what happens? I mean, what do you think happens? I mean, you kind of answered the question, which is, like, if Jules doesn't leave... John Travolta doesn't die, right? Or
yeah,
I mean, that's just he doesn't die if he doesn't leave, right? But they, it's, do you see, I guess the question that I asked Luke when we were watching the movie, because we watched it together, was, do you see like the is the movie telling, like, is the movie giving hints to Jules and Vincent to leave this life, you know what I'm saying? Because Jules gets only the ones, right, where they get shot and the guy misses all his shots, right? He's like, I'm out, fuck it, right? And he's got the whole body situation that they got to deal with. And then Vincent gets a different one also with the big man's wife. He gets a big thing also where he gets all of that, and then he gets another one on top of it where he goes out with a date, treats her to a good night, and then she basically almost ODs on him. And he's going through hell. He's like, man, I got to stop doing this shit. Or he's like, he almost is giving, like, I should just quit now, right? Almost like another reason to leave. Do you think the movie feels like, is that giving it to him? It's like the movie's trying to almost like force him, like, you should leave now before your luck runs out almost.
Yeah, man, that's an interesting point. Yeah, I can see that. It's like they're giving, it's like the fates are giving him an out the same way that Jules saw it clearly, and yes. Vincent's not seeing it. And he's too wrapped up in his own stuff.
Or in that book. He can't stop reading that book in the toilet. It's unreal.
Well, it's because he's constipated. That's what heroin gives you, constipation. If he was clean, he'd probably take a normal shit and he wouldn't be constipated. Yeah, he wouldn't take so much time on the toilet and he wouldn't have died.
I guess if heroin wasn't back and coke was still alive, he'd be good.
Right.
Remember, because in the beginning,
he'd have more energy.
Coke is dead. Heroin is back in a big way.
You know, this time I noticed that joke more when he's having that conversation about the coke and, you know, at Eric Stoltz's house before the whole ODing stuff. And he's talking about his car and how someone keyed it. And he was like, "That you should be killed, straight up executed." And they say all this.
Oh, stuff, yeah, right? For fucking with a man's car.
Never fuck with another man's vehicle, right? And then later on when he has Uma Thurman's, Mia driving, ODing and crashes his keyed car straight into Eric Stoltz.
Yeah, but that's him fucking with his own vehicle. Is that another man?
Yeah, right. I know. Yeah. But it's just like,
it's okay when you do it.
An exaggerated
right, exactly. Of that. Yeah. Sorry.
All right. I mean, I know this movie. We all know this movie has been talked to death, but it's good to rehash it, because we know we're coming up on a lot of people who did not grow up with this movie. We're that old now where people have not, this is not a staple. Unless they're purposely getting into cinema, it's not a real huge staple. It isn't, you know, a Disney movie, which easily any child can grow up with, even from the 60s Disney movies or 70s or whatever. This Pulp Fiction, no one grows up with it unless you seek it out, or unless you were alive at the time. But, you know, it's good to touch back either way, and we should always You know, this movie still holds the test of everything. It's, it means that a good movie comes from any decade, right? Not just today or anything like that. And not the now, at ever. You know, without Madonna, there's no Pulp Fiction. Tarantino talks, you know, in his movies as much or as well. Without whatever, and we don't have this movie. And without this, we don't have another movie, you know. So it all kind of fits everything together. Luke, do you have any last thingamabob?
What's your favorite segment?
Story?
Yep.
Shit. I think it's got to be, and it wasn't at first. It was always the Vincent Mia was always for a long time.
Right.
But I think it has shifted to the Bruce Willis ones because that story has the strangest turn with the whole.
It does. It does. Yeah. With a gimp and everything. And Zed.
Super strange. I don't think Americans ever saw anything like that until that movie came out in the 90s.
Right.
You know, like that was my first time too. I'm like, what is going on? I'm pretty sure I blacked that out. Like when I was younger watching the movie for the first time.
Mom, what's a gimp?
What's a gimp? Right. What do they need all this leather for? Right. Like what's right. Really bizarre. That's a bizarre exchange.
Could you imagine asking your mom, what's a gimp?
Oh, God.
Yeah.
Or like, explain, what's going on in this scene, mom? Why are they taking him to the back? Why are they grunting?
Why are they grunting? Oh, my God.
Yeah. And then him going to the hammer, to the bat, to the...
The sword?
And then the sword. To the samurai sword.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So good.
Is that Quentin Tarantino's obsession with samurai swords? Or is it just Japanese? Oh,
yeah,
obsession with
Asian movie. Yeah, Asian cinema. That's what he loves, that stuff.
Right.
Yeah, he loves that stuff. But it's a precursor to Kill Bill, right? Which is like a big thing for him.
Right.
Yeah,
bro, that's my favorite story. What's your favorite?
Oh, man, that's such a good question. I don't know, bro. I still gotta say the beginning of the movie, just the whole Jules Ezekiel 25:17. I mean, I don't know that part where he's just like some random ass shit to say. Like the first time you hear it, you're like, what kind of shit is it? Like, why is he quoting the Bible? Like, what the hell is going on? Yeah. You know, and it's cool. Like he just used this newfound information that fit perfect for the scene where he knows, you know, like this little tidbit of what they call a Big Mac in France because he happens to eat this guy's burger, and then he drinks his whole Sprite. But, you know, and he's like, wow, this guy's actually smart. I didn't even know that. Even more of a reason to kill this motherfucker. Like it's when you watch it like 600 times, you know?
Yeah.
So I think that part's still very, very influential to me. I mean, I could still quote that scene, probably verbatim.
It also tells you that a small scene where they're just talking bullshit in the car about Big Macs and where to smoke weed and, you know, what Mia Wallace did when, you know.
Yeah.
Like all those things, they sound so inconsequential, but it comes up in the movie.
Everything, every single thing they talk about, it comes up in the movie. Right. It's such a great little thing in the big whole beginning car ride and everything. I mean, it's not quite time yet to go kill somebody. What do you mean? Like it's like fucking like who takes like a quick joke. Like. That's it is. It is. I get.
The scene's not ready yet.
Scene's not ready yet. No, I know. It's just like no, didn't get the signal. Let me go ahead and spend some time real quick. You know. But yeah, that's that whole beginning is just still one of my favorites. The whole movie's my favorite, of course, but yeah, that beginning scene is great. How about yours?
The wolf.
Nice.
It's just that man is just so thorough in everything he does.
Yeah.
And just how 30 minutes away, I'll be there in 10. 9 minutes, 38 seconds.
38 seconds.
It's amazing how he acts and how he thinks and how thorough he is. Like his process is immaculate,
and his solutions are, you know, when you think about it, they're super simple, but you know they're all freaking out, they have a time stamp, you know, they have a time constraint,
right?
And he just fucking acts and it's good.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And also that story has my favorite line in the movie when they're cleaning out the blood and the skull bits from the car.
Oh yeah,
Jules and Vincent.
What line?
It's I'm a mushroom cloud wearing motherfucker, motherfucker, or something like that. And then he says, every time these fingers touch brain, I'm superfly TNT. Like that whole thing, that whole spiel when he's yelling at Vincent, that's my favorite lines of the movie. I'm not going to quote the whole thing. He does it way better. Just watch the movie. But yeah, that's a good one. We all have favorite stories. That's interesting. Different ones. That's good.
Dope.
Yeah, I think that's all we have on Pulp Fiction. But the world has had a lot of them. So, you know, everyone check this movie out. Again, it's always worth it. And check back the review after you watch it again. You might notice something interesting. We're going to take another break here. When we return, we're going to go into Luke's choice for a movie, which is going to be Chasing Amy. Stay with us.
No. You go over what he draws with a pen, all right? That's Tracy.
Not really. Next.
Hey, man. Let me ask you something. Somebody draws something and then draw the exact same thing, like right on top of it, without going outside the original designated art. What do you call it?
I don't know, man. Tracing?
See?
You want your book signed or what?
Hey! Don't get all testy with him just because you got a problem with your station in life.
Oh, I'm secure with what I do.
Then just say it. You're a tracer.
How should I sign this?
I don't want you to sign it, man. I want the guy that draws Blunt Man Chronic to sign it. I'm just a tracer.
Tell him. I'll shave her.
Who do I sign it to?
I'm not gonna let them see you fucking tracer!
Trace a chocolate around your dead fucking body, you fuck!
Hey, would you get him out of here?
Hey, wait a second! He's your me! You fucking tracer!
Your mother's a tracer!
Can I explain the audience principle to you? If you insult and accost him, then we have no audience.
He started it, fucking cock knocker! He's lucky I didn't put my pen through a thorax!
Holden and Banky are comic book artists. Everything's going good for them until they meet Amy, also a comic book artist. Holden falls for her, but his hopes are crushed when he finds out she's a lesbian. Chasing Amy. By the one and only Kevin Smith. Starring Ben Affleck.
You know her name is not Amy, right?
Well, yeah.
Okay. Just making sure. Her name is Alyssa. Okay. I just was making sure. I don't know if you had like mind fart or not in your brain. Okay. Continue. Sorry.
That's funny. That's interesting that it says that in the IMDb description.
Oh, that's what it says?
Yeah.
You read it off something? Oh, I thought
yeah,
that
I
was
did.
You speaking.
No.
Oh, fuck. The IMDb doesn't know what the fuck it's talking
no,
about.
No, it does not.
Oh, wow.
Damn, son. They fucked up. They fucked up.
Yeah. Okay.
Oh, yeah. So aside from Ben Affleck, you also got, you know, Jason Lee, Casey Affleck's in there. Joey Lauren Adams before she got blacklisted, Matt Damon.
Why did she get blacklisted?
I don't know. She did something.
Okay,
but you don't see her after like I think this, and I think was she in Rounders?
I know I saw that movie. I know I liked it back whenever it came out, but I don't remember.
Yeah. Anyways,
John Turturro was a bad guy or something.
So yeah. Chasing Amy. We all have seen it.
Mm-hmm.
I think we all like it. I do, personally, obviously. Oscar, what are your thoughts on this one?
Oh, wow. Short and sweet for you, huh? My thoughts on this movie is that it was my go-to if I ever want to sell Kevin Smith to anyone. It was my go-to example.
That is a definite, movie. Yep.
For his best movie, because of how he managed, and it seems as almost accidentally, but I know that I feel like it's not, but it feels like it is. Like he just stumbled upon this great rhythm somehow of his style and his dialogue, you know, the way he writes, and he just got into this somehow, fell into this awesome premise and this awesome concept and this awesome like great intimacy. There's great intimacy in conversations with this movie that. Before Chasing Amy, I hadn't really seen. And I know I've seen that in many other movies since and after. And there's a lot of like LGBTQ movies like that and stuff like that, you know, of all that kind of thing. But this movie does all those things, but does it in a lighthearted, you know, stuff around it that makes it way easier to consume or way easier to like take notice or way easier to pay attention to. And that rhythm, that's what Chasing Amy has, and that's like its power, in my opinion, and that's why it's, in my opinion, the best Kevin Smith movie. Now, Red State came pretty close, and Red State is another discussion for a different day.
Yeah,
and Red State's it's a better movie technologically. I think technically it's a better movie, probably, but ultimately though, Chasing Amy strikes the right chord for me. than any of his other movies. And some of them come close, though. Like, I really like Clerks, and I really like Dogma and stuff. But I love Chasing Amy, you know? So, yeah, that's just my general opinions on the movie.
All right. Ralph, what are your general opinions on this movie?
The general opinions of this movie is that it is a movie about love and such. It is an hour and 53 minutes.
What the fuck are you doing?
That's my general opinion of the movie.
Okay.
What do I say? I kind of mirror Oscar's thing. I wouldn't pick this as my movie to tell people what up, because it's so different from what it is. Besides his dialogue, the dialogue is great, in a very Kevin Smith way. Screenplay wise, but it's I wouldn't pick this movie as, because it'd be like lying to somebody. I want to give him something else. This is what he really makes, and Chasing Amy is probably the best culmination of what he's made and stuff like that. And more serious.
I mean, it still has dick and farts humor.
Don't get me wrong, it still does. Yeah, but I mean, it just tones it down a lot. But I actually take a lot of. I think it was kind of a good timing this movie came out in for me, like right before high school. And I know I saw it during high school. I didn't see it when it came out. I saw it like, I think in 2000s or something like that. So it came out like really good time right before high school for me when I saw it. And it actually kind of stuck with me with the notes of like what's her name? I can't think of her name in the movie. Alyssa.
Yeah.
Joey Lauren Adams' character.
Alyssa from Last Night, Alyssa?
Yeah. Finger cuffs. Who has this like this part where she tells Holden, Ben Affleck's character, that like, you know, it's like you can't just bring your shit down on me and blah 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 blah, blah and stuff like that. And then stuff like that, like just unbearing his world on her. And then also that just the one part in the very end where he's not just like, she's not like the whole Chasing Amy part of the movie, right? Which is like, you know, he's still lingering on the fact that this person has all this baggage with her. That stuck with me a lot in my life. I just never let that get to me, especially in my love life. It's just, it is what it is. Like that person had their own shit. I did my own shit. Who gives a fuck? Like, it is what it is. Like, it's not about what happened then. It's about what's happening between me and her, me and the person, you know? So yeah, I would say that very influential movie for me in that aspect. So overall, very powerful movie for me.
All right.
Yeah.
So yeah, it is one of my favorites, mainly because
obviously
the dialogue, and it has some of the most memorable dialogues to me, especially with fucking Banky.
Yeah, he's like the audience for Kevin Smith.
He is like the favorite.
Yeah,
just because of like how
he's the Randall in this movie.
Oh, very much so.
Yeah, it's like when he comes to the thing, like, "Hey, we're in a lesbian bar," like that like
a lot of chicks in here.
Right.
Chicks
in here. Yeah. That or when he's like, "Oh, I don't go down on chicks," and like he has to explain himself to two lesbians. It's like one of the best things ever.
That scene is an homage to Jaws when they're talking about remember Jaws when they're in the boat and the old captain and the marine biologist guy, they're talking about their scars they've had from bites from fish and sharks.
Oh, right.
Oh, yeah. And yeah, that's a very Jaws scene. Yeah.
That's exactly where it's from. Yeah. That's exactly where it's from. Yeah. It's really nice, too, because those are their horror stories in Chasing Amy in that bar is, you know, more relatable to shark bites, you know.
Right.
So, like, yeah, I mean, I can think of one or two, you know, like, you know, stories like that, that of their ilk that I could bring onto that conversation if I were there. So, yeah, it's really interesting. It's a funny one.
Right. And aside from that, it's like, it's a great, you know, rom-com, and it's heavy on the comedy. And the story is like, it's a little bit different because normally your rom-com is, you know, boy meets girl and they're both, you know, heterosexuals. And here, one is a lesbian. So, obviously, she's not going for the dick.
Right.
And it sucks because like this guy like literally like madly like falls in love with her.
Yeah.
And then they have that huge fucking scene in like the rain, you know, where he just kind of like pours his heart out, and then, you know, it happens. I don't know if she caves, or, you know, I guess she has feelings for him too, but it's it's slightly different than what, you know, what you're used to in this genre.
It is. It's weird because she's so much more confident and she's so much, she knows more about herself than he ever will know about himself.
Yeah.
And she knows that she can back up her, like, she can follow something and then know how to back it up in her words and how to define it and stuff like that. In comparison to him, he just doesn't know any better, and he doesn't know if it's just like a puppy love kind of thing or not. Like, there's a big difference between them and just how they understand things.
Yeah. Yeah, I definitely agree with that. This movie is, I mean, and it has a ridiculous premise, like the selfish notion that, I mean, when you look at it as face value, right? The selfish notion is that to have a straight guy convince,
right?
A lesbian to turn away from that orientation or whatever, that sexual lifestyle, to go with him because he's that something. Or whatever, because the movie somehow, rom-com, you know, law dictates that.
Right.
But it gets past that in such a subtle and interesting ways. It does things that along the way to make that feel realistic to just the two characters. It makes it real for the two characters, not for a stereotype or not for a certain type of person. It doesn't make it like, because you saw this movie, it's totally possible for it to happen in real life. No, it's just possible for these two people, for how they come up with it, and obviously the movie makes fun of itself too, along the way by making, jabbing at Holden a few times of his inadequacies and stuff like that. But also seriously, like Ralph was mentioning, talking about like making that an actual point of the movie that this guy doesn't fully know what Alyssa knows about herself.
He's a more conservative guy. He's, you know,
yeah. It's for him. It's the standard, right?
Right. Well, like the whole conversation they had, like also when they were on the swings, and he's like, "Well, how did you know that was the normal for you?" That kind of thing.
Yeah, that's a really, really powerful conversation to have. And it's actually a cool thing to just kind of look at it in a different perspective that you're not used to. And especially for somebody who is a normal, I would consider all three of us a normal, especially then, it's just like the normal way or traditional way of looking at things. It's cool to be able to have someone else explain it to you and not make you feel dumb about it or not make you feel like less than about it also. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. It's just kind of explaining it to you.
It's a hard discussion.
It is a hard discussion. It's a very hard discussion, but at the same time, it's also like a cool thing to just know, and for someone to tell you, someone who's obviously going through it in the movie, who's like telling you just firsthand knowledge, and it feels like, oh shit, like, oh okay, I didn't know that. You know, it's like if you never met a gay person, and you're like, what are you like? Then you don't know anything about gay people. It's the same thing.
But it lets the audience, because of, like most of us, like it gave me that opening too, or that awakening of that kind of notion. It's too rough when I saw it in the 90s. That you're having a conversation with someone who is patient enough to answer it back to you. And obviously you're not in that conversation, but it feels like you are because you're in Holden's shoes, asking questions, trying to figure it out, trying to understand. And you're with this Alyssa chick who isn't yelling back or anything like that, is just explaining and trying to explain. Right. And that conversation goes a long way with a lot, I'm sure it did anyway, with a lot of people who, like I said, like you said, never met a gay person of any kind. Or doesn't have that in their circle, you know, and it helps understand, and it helped me understand a lot of like you know, just not to take sexuality like your own preferences to others, you know, like things like that. It kind of lets you think those things.
Yeah, very much so. Yeah.
All right. But I also agree. This movie was kind of like a big eye opener for me too, as far as like the conversations that they had. They were like, I never really knew any lesbians at that point because I think you actually showed it to me in what, early 2000s Oscar?
Probably.
Anywhere from like what, 2002 to 2006-ish maybe?
Right.
Sure. So like I said, I didn't know a lot of people. And, sure. I don't know. I didn't know a lot of people like that, you know, that were like LGBT, you know, so.
Yeah.
It was a good little introduction to that world.
We were growing up and still people were completely in the closet. And it was right. Nobody. So I mean, you knew of gay people. I mean, LGBTQ, but that really that you never actually knew somebody unless if someone came out to you.
Problem was, like, you know, if you looked at, like, you know, like 90s like portrayal of like gay people on like TV and stuff was like really weird. It was almost like like a joke,
exaggerated, or there was the bad guy or something,
something like that. Whereas this movie, it's like, hey, you know, it's like, hey, gay people are here. They're normal people. You could talk to them, have a beer with them.
Yeah, and we have Hooper X, too,
who is amazing character. A minority of a minority.
And no one's, you know, taking care of my black ass. Right, I love that. That's a good line.
Yeah. What's a Nubian? Yeah, and that was one amazing scene.
Yes. No, that was great. I mean, his character is a quintessential type of, like, where he kind of, you know, he keeps to himself, and, you know, he's only with people that like don't judge him and things like that. You know, you see his easiness with Holden and with Panky, who, you know, and again, he is like another way in, another like angle of something. And in movies and cinema, like, Hooper is a rare character, you know, at that time. Anyway.
Yeah,
more or less. Anyway, and because other movies would be a bigger point, like too big of a point in the movie if Hooper, like if Hooper's character was in another kind of movie, or in another kind of movie, he would be like marginalized completely differently, like way lesser. He wouldn't have an opinion of his own, things like that. But this movie gives him those things, and he's by far just a supporting character. But yeah, he's instrumental, but not instrumental, you know. And it's good. What else you guys want to talk about in this movie?
Luke.
Do you guys think, like, Banky, because he was obviously against this whole Alyssa thing, mm-hmm. like, do you think Banky was, like, afraid that he would lose his best friend because he actually had, like, feelings for him that he didn't realize he had? Or you thought this might end bad in the future, so why risk it?
That's interesting. I have thought of that before, and I thought of it this time. And I guess my conclusion ultimately is that I don't know. The answer is no. He didn't have that kind of feeling for him, but he never. But I think the whole Alyssa triangle with him, I guess, gave him the idea to think about it. Like, it gave him thoughts, and he wasn't sure what they meant about his relationship or how much he wanted to, quote unquote, keep Holden, you know, in the same apartment with him, you know? But ultimately, I think it was more about his best friend and then worrying about, like, ideally Holden moving out or breaking that bond, you know, by, you know, with their work. And for him, you know, I mean, we see he's an asshole. He's a huge asshole, and he's very loud and obtrusive, and you can see it's hard for him to be friends with other people. So, like, he's got just Holden, you know, and like other people tolerate him on a certain level, but not the way that his best friend Holden is. And I think most of his fears come from that, I feel. And that's ultimately what I came down with. I don't think he's like a gay or like had anything like that going on. He had thoughts, but I don't think it was something he would have or wanted to act on.
Right. Yeah. Do you guys have any favorite scenes from this movie? Because mine is going to be the hockey scene where he's kind of questioning Alyssa as the hockey game is going on, and you see these like really, hockey scenes.
Really not subtle.
Not subtle at all. No. It's blatantly,
you
know, out
that's
there.
That's such a guy trope to do, by the way. It's like you feel like you have a higher ground if you do it, if you have a conversation with somebody in public.
Oh, because they won't act out, maybe?
They won't act out, or you'll get a better reaction, or better, like, as in, like, favorable reaction because they won't act out, or because, I don't know, you just feel like it's dumb. It's like it's a weird, dumb thing that I think a lot of men have, because like I know I've done it before where I've had a conversation about, like, why am I having a conversation? And you think about it, like, why did I say anything now? Why couldn't I say that when I was at home, just me and her? Like, makes no sense.
Yeah. Have you guys ever felt, not that you got to go into specifics because, you know, it's okay, but you guys ever felt anything in the notion of what Alyssa's coming through, like, like where she stands when the truth of finger cuffs comes out and Holden is overwhelmed by it. Either do you feel, have you ever felt that what Holden is going through or what Alyssa has gone through? You know, because you could have both sides. You could have both sides in one lifetime too. But like, do you feel, have you ever felt like Holden or Alyssa when it came to this finger cuff history lesson?
No, not that I think of. Not that I can think of at the moment, actually, right now. So, sorry to disappoint.
No, it's okay. I was just asking. Because I have from both sides. You know, so it's very strange and very, very sobering to watch it again now. Now having, you know, lived 36 years. So like, and shut up. you know, it's like the first time I saw it, I had no idea. The movie was just eye-opening to a lot of things I didn't know, but it wasn't like I couldn't never relate to them. I saw it too early, you know, and not saw it too early to relate to it. But once I started relating to it and I would see it over the years, not that I see this movie all the time, it's like probably my 10th time watching it, maybe less, maybe more. You know, somewhere in the 2000s, you know, I got what Holden was feeling. You know, I got that notion. I'm not saying I had the same fight the way he did or whatever. I probably handled some events differently or better, some of it worse.
You didn't go to a hockey game?
No, nope. Didn't do it like
all a right, good.
Game. No. I don't think I've ever been to a hockey game. And then now, you know, more so now, it's, you know, my later years, I guess, it's like, I definitely feel more like Alyssa, way more. And like just trying to be patient, just talk it out.
Right, right.
And it's like, it was a time and a place, and it should not be
anything. New Orleans, else. Hooker, blackout drunk.
Yeah. I've
been. We weren't going to go specifics, by the way, but okay. Right.
I just threw those out of my head. I'm sorry.
That's funny. I've been in a similar situation before. I felt like Holden, but actually just like for a minutia amount, very small. Like I know where he's coming from, but like I said, because of this movie and stuff like that, it's just like I just didn't care. I didn't care to care enough. You know what I'm saying? Like I felt like it for a split second and then I was like, why do I feel like that? It had nothing to do with me. And I talked myself out of it, out of feeling like that. And I felt conflicted, don't get me wrong, but at the same time, I still felt like, okay, like, just get over it. And I did, and then it just went away. And then I was just like, oh, okay, you're good.
Yeah.
Really weird. Very adult of me.
For me, very adult. Yeah, good job. The way I would feel nowadays is that I would rather meet someone who's more an Alyssa type, like someone who has a lot of different kinds of experiences, rather than someone who isn't.
Right.
I would probably be turned off by someone who doesn't
understand. No, I would agree with you. I would agree with you 100%, yes.
I probably wouldn't be Alyssa in that situation and explain things or have to explain things or anything like that. So I would say that if anything, I'm probably more, more, you know.
Better have two Alyssas than a, right.
Right.
Well, it's our experiences help shape us. That's plain and simple. Right. And it's like, lack of experience just, makes you feel incompetent to the other person if the other person has experience. I've been there before many times. Not just in my sex life, but yeah, I mean, that is what it is.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I don't care. Like I said, I just got over it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, yeah.
Final thing I'm going to ask you guys. God. How did you feel about the Chasing Amy cameo in the reboot movie?
Oh.
Because obviously you kind of have closure in that aspect of like what happened to Alyssa and Holden, right?
I mean, I felt the exact same way I felt at the end of Chasing Amy. I didn't need it. I didn't need the reboot to tell me anything more. Because I knew that she wasn't going to get back to him, and the movie just proved what I knew already, that they weren't going to get back in some
way. But were you happy that they still had like that friendship thing going on and have the kid?
But Chasing Amy at the end told me that they were going to stay amicable, at least with the book that he wrote. Like that's his apology on top being something he felt like he had to say. You know, how he said he wanted something personal to say in a comic book in the future. So it did both things. It's an apology, and it is a testament, and it is something that he felt he had something personal to say. So the end of the Chasing Amy gave me everything I needed Whereas in Reboot, it just amplified it. I guess it just did the same by just showing some future. It is it is nicer, though, to find out about the whole, you know, he has a kid with them, with the whole, with Alyssa and her wife.
That's, yeah,
that was, I didn't see that, I guess, but I didn't know that was coming. But yeah, it's nicer. It made it everything more tender, for sure. So yeah, I liked it. Yeah,
gotta love it tender. All right, what about you, Ralph?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't feel anything. I just thought it was, oh, that's cool. Like, the, literally how I felt.
Okay.
I was like, oh, okay, that's cool. I mean, I didn't think anything extra of it. I thought it was, I thought it was a cool thing to tie up, like, the universe. But overall, like, it was just like, oh, okay, that's cool. Like, I didn't see, it didn't hit me. I guess it wasn't as impactful.
I guess I think I liked it more because it is one of my favorite movies. So I was really happy to see that that had happened. And then, you know, she's still with that girl she was with, you know, back at the end of Chasing Amy, but they got the kid now, and, you know, kind of sucks that he, you know, get it in one last time, but whatever.
Right. Wow. Wow. Totally. I mean, technically, you touch back with Banky, too. He has a fight, and he has a comic book store in a mall.
Right. Failing. And he's,
Yeah, no, I mean, yeah, I just feel like he just didn't add anything more to it, you know, but it's good. I'm glad it did more for you. Yeah. I do have one last thing, though,
about the Chasing
Amy story when Kevin Smith, well, Silent Bob, tells a story.
Yeah.
Now, do you feel like this is, now the movie kind of metally, in a meta way, I guess, talks about, you know, not being able to do something until he has something personal to say. In a way, Chasing Amy, the movie, feels like that's what it is. It's for Holden what it is for Kevin Smith. It feels that way. I'm not saying it's true,
but it could be, like, yeah.
Right. And that story he tells in that diner to Holden that opens up the ending that it fails completely.
Feels very personal.
Yeah. Feels very personal. It feels like it's something close to, do you guys feel like that's the case? That's what got this movie made? That's what got this movie written by Kevin Smith?
I don't know. That would be an interesting question to ask him one day.
Well, I'm sure he's been asked before. I don't know if he answered in in the positive or not. But,
I don't know.
Well, I was just asking if you feel like it did happen. That's all. I mean, I don't know.
I do. I feel like some part of it did happen.
Hmm. Yeah, I feel the same. I guess one last thing about Holden's solution at the end. I mean, the movie, I mean, one of those things that, I mean, the movie did it right, but had the movie gone through with that plan, the whole movie would have fallen apart, in my
opinion. Oh, yeah.
That's one of those things where, like, it's a good thing you don't go with, like, because the movie actively chooses to go against the main character, right, at the end there, when Alyssa tells him, I'm not your whore, and slaps him and leaves.
Classic.
Classic, right? But like it's good. It's a good thing that happened. It gives you actual reflection to everything in a better, more realistic way. Had it not, you know, I mean, I'm glad they didn't fucking go with the menage a trois.
Right.
Right. Anyway, that's how I feel. I assume you guys feel similar.
Oh yeah.
Yep.
Cool. Now that's all I got.
All right.
All right. So that's
all right. Chasing. Cool. Yeah, we'll take a quick break right then, and we're gonna be back with Oscar's pick of There Will Be Blood.
The funny thing is, listen. I paid him $10,000 cash in hand. Like that. He has his own company now. A prosperous little business, three wells producing $5,000 a week. Stop crying, you sniveling ass. Stop your nonsense. You're just the afterbirth, Eli.
No.
Slithered out on your mother's filth.
No.
They should have put you in a glass jar on the mantelpiece. Where were you when Paul was suckling at his mother's teat? Where were you? Who was nursing you, poor Eli? One of Bandy's sounds? That land has been had. Nothing you can do about it. It's gone. It's had.
If you would just take this lease, Daniel.
Drain it, Eli, you boy. Drain dry. I'm so sorry. If you have a milkshake, and I have a milkshake, and I have a straw, there it is. That's a straw, you see. Watching. my straw reaches across the room and starts to drink your milkshake, I drink your milkshake. I drink it up.
Don't bully me, Daniel.
A story of family, religion, hatred, oil, and madness, focusing on a turn-of-a-century prospector in the early days of the business. This is There Will Be Blood. Wonderful title. One of my favorite titles of any movie ever. It invites so much intrigue right away. This movie, written and directed by Paul Thomas Anderson, based on the novel by Upton Sinclair called Oil, with an exclamation part. And I read excerpts of that book. That's how much I was into this movie when it came out. And it stars Daniel Day-Lewis, of course, the great Daniel Day-Lewis, Paul Dano, and Kieran Hines, for example, Warren Singer, Barry Del Sherman, a bunch of people. But, you know, Daniel Day-Lewis is the real star. He's in virtually every scene. And Paul Dano has his...
arch rival.
His co-star, arch rival, nemesis type, right? This is The Will Be Blood. I will obviously go first. This is the one I picked. Interesting that the older guy picks the more recent movies.
Because you can't remember the old ones that well.
Clearly not so. Clearly not. I remember way more, you punk. Damn it, get off my lawn. Yeah, The Will Be Blood is a wonderfully horrible movie. It's a movie about horrible things. It's
To you, it's what?
No, it's not a horrible movie, but it's like really good at being a terrible, like showing a lot of terrible things. I mean, there is no one to love in this movie except for the boy.
H.W.
Plainview. That's right. Plainview. It's a strange movie. It has a lot of it's a movie that I think encapsulates a huge thing that fits America. You know, America from of its time in the early 1900s, and it fits a lot of the things and themes with today in many ways. And very little of that has to do with violence. Not to say that there isn't violent stuff in this movie, but it isn't about that. I know a lot of people think Americans equal violence, and we have a lot of that for sure. But this movie, I think it's a great essay or poetry of showing what it is to like to the feel of an American in terms of like what they seek out for, what's important to them, the selfish American, the egocentric American, the capitalist in a certain type of American persona. And this movie has all of those themes wrapped up in the main character, right? Played by Daniel Day-Lewis. And it shows, throughout the whole movie, shows how ridiculous those actions can be, but also how, you know, it also shows a positive side by showing the negative is that this guy is determined. This guy won't stop at nothing. This guy will, that problem is that he will railroad his grandmother to get what he wants. But the thing is that he is so intense and focused on being isolated from the rest of the world because that's how much he hates the world. That's like a true sense of self-preservation and selfishness that is rarely seen in movies. And to have that as the main character go through these trials of like some of it cautionary tales, some of it of his own making, some of it positive kind of like success stories, like it's nuts. And and when we get to the end, it's a horrible sight to see. And this movie is wonderful to watch. It's wonderful to watch this horrible man go through all these things. And, you know, and he doesn't suffer enough, nearly enough. He shouldn't be successful because of what he turns out to be, what kind of person he always has been. He shouldn't, but he is. And that's almost like the true sad fact about how a lot of industrial tycoons have have personified themselves or have personified themselves to the public over the years, especially with a hot topic like oil and like gas and that kind of like resource in our country and what we do nowadays with overseas. It really taps into all of that, and I think this movie does it really wonderfully. Ralph, what did you think of There Will Be Blood?
Everything you said. Next person. No, I'm kidding.
Wow.
I know, right? There Will Be Blood. What a great movie. I mean, nothing – just the beginning of this movie tells you like just what you're kind of in for. Hard work. A lot of hard work went in back. You had to do everything. This is a man who literally is like, – I would say like just a man who's the American – dream. If you work hard and if you actually put the time and effort into something, a little bit of luck obviously, and a whole lot of charisma and follow through, you can become a millionaire, you can become a whatever nair, you can do kind of what you want in the United States, and in America for him it ends up happening for Daniel Day-Lewis's character, what's his name, Daniel Plainview. Yeah, Daniel. The first 5 minutes, there's not a word said until he falls and says no when he wakes up. Like, that's the first word he says. And the whole movie was like the first word, and then still there's nothing.
For like another
3-4 minutes. Yeah, I think so. And total 10 minutes, yeah. But and you're like, what the fuck? Like, what's going on in this movie? But it just shows you there's a man who like spilt this from nothing essentially,
and from the ground up
literally, yeah. and then obviously he, what he did to take advantage of situations and stuff like that, but I don't know, it's a really cool movie, I love the timeline. It ends in the 20s, am I correct?
Like, yes,
1927. So,
27? I thought it was one. I couldn't. The numbers were a little bit too fancy for me.
The font is
the font. Yeah. Yeah, the font is old.
Yeah, Oscar knows the font. He's well endowed with those old fonts.
Well endowed. Yeah. That being said, he did the movie. What's it called? Like when it ends, it ends at a interesting time because it's the 20s, which is the Great Depression. Which is the Great Depression, but he like. He's nothing to worry about, it's just interesting to see like just the whole movie, what it like, I don't know, there's a whole shit ton to talk about this movie, of course, but it's interesting to see a man and like how, I guess, how far you can go on your own, and even then he wants to have some sense of family, and it's just his own fault. He gets in his own way really, in one aspect, and in another aspect, he opens up too much. But it's a super cool movie, and I'm great pick, by the way, Oscar.
Thank you.
So yeah, it's a really, really great movie to watch. It just kind of drags you in there. Daniel Day-Lewis is obviously one of the best actors we've seen on screen.
Hmm. Luke?
I think it's one of the best movies that came out, I think, that decade. And it's one of the...
2008, I think it came out.
That was 2007.
Maybe you're right.
Eh, who cares? Anyways, I remember still seeing this movie in theaters, and it was just like, okay. Especially like Rob mentioned that beginning piece where everything's just fucking dead silent, and then the scene that always comes to my head with this movie is when there's that fire at the on the oil rig. And he's just like staring at it.
Yeah.
It's got some like really great visuals.
Damn, those visuals were amazing. You know that scene, because it takes place, I think it starts off at dusk or at night.
Right.
And then it goes into the morning, which is a hell. That's a crazy fire, by the way.
Right.
That scene, because they really did that fire. You could see that in the background, one of the shootings for No Country for Old Men, which came out the same year.
Really?
And they were shooting around the same like.
Oh, that's area. Amazing.
You could see, yeah, it's in the background in one of the shots. I don't know if it's one of the shots that make it to the main movie, but I think so. And there was actual like back and forth and stuff.
Gotcha. All right. Yeah, I mean, it is a very powerful, you know, movie. Like visually, it is great. The character, I mean, fucking, I think this is like one of my first Daniel Day-Lewis movies. So okay. I don't remember seeing anything else before that. And that started for me like holy shit, this guy is amazing.
Yeah.
And then you told me about like all his other stuff that he does.
My Left Foot. Mm-hmm. The Boxer.
I think, I don't know. I saw Gangs of New York, but I don't know if it was because of There Will Be Blood.
Probably. I mean, we were pretty excited for Daniel Day-Lewis. I think we were on his bandwagon by then.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And then I think was that Nine, the musical. Was that the one?
That's right. Yeah. With the guy who did Chicago, I think.
Right. Yeah. Good old Lincoln.
Lincoln. Right.
What else did he do?
Phantom Thread. He did. He was in
Phantom Thread. This is the one. That's the most recent one I haven't seen of his.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, obviously, he's amazing in it.
Right.
He commands such presence in that movie.
He is. I mean, it just he's so memorable, especially like the last couple minutes of the movie with the whole thing with him and Eli, the little confrontation and his little one-liners.
Yeah.
It's insanely quotable at the same time.
It is
also very memorable. Like it's not all the stuff that it talks about and it shows and stuff. You would think it would be like musty or like too thick to like, you know, penetrate most audiences, but it's so quotable. Everything the situations are so interesting and then the lines are so quotable. I quote, you know, there's this line, I quote this all the time, usually in front of Lexi, when we're trying to decide, like, what to eat, for example, which is an age-old dilemma that
couples have. Of course.
Age-old. Fucking Christ. This is a problem that happens all the time. She knows I make fun of her for it. But when we finally come down to a decision, I would often say, like, there's a pipeline. because that's what he says when he has to, like, in order to get the band tract to buy off that last piece of land, he has to go, like, get baptized. And he gets slapped around by Eli, and he has to say that he abandoned his child. And he's like, just hurry up, come on. He's like trying to tell him, come on, hurry up. And he starts leaning into the ridiculousness of it. And then at the end of it, after he gets poured with the water, he's like, there's a pipeline. And so I quote that all the time. It's great. And then the milkshake line.
Right. Yeah. Drainage.
Yeah, drainage. anything else to say? Sorry, I interrupted you.
No, that's fine. It is a great movie, and I know some of our friends hate this movie due to its length and its pacing sometimes.
Yeah.
I mean, honestly, you could literally
Who hates this movie?
Come on, Ralph.
Come on, we both know.
Who else saw this movie with us?
Oh, yeah.
And still to this day.
Yeah. But, yeah, I mean, honestly, like, there's these heavy segments of this movie, like, you literally, like, the whole brother thing, you know, his brother shows up. You could literally cut that entire thing out of the movie, and it'd still be fine.
No, I mean, you could still be fine in some elements of the movie, but I feel it's very necessary. I think everything unnecessary is in this movie, and I mean, I was gonna get to that later, but we can get to it now. The brother thing, I think, is super interesting. Now, before Luke, and I guess it still is my least favorite part of the whole movie because it feels like it is like. Not in the way, but it is like a different thing that happens in the middle of the movie around the oil thing, around his son thing, around the Eli problem. It happens around that, right? But his brother comes at a very opportune time that caught him unawares. This is his brother there is what sealed his egocentric, selfish fate with himself.
He
like lost all sense of that kind of familial chase, what Ralph was talking about, about having a family or feeling the need for a family, you know, because that's something that every human on this planet is imbued with. That's genetic, you know, that's something we seek for, community and all that. And this guy gave that up when he found out his brother was lying, well, his brother was not his brother, and that he was lying to him, and his retribution was swift and, you know, with the gun and all that. And but it demolished the last shred of humanity, I guess. Or,
yeah, I guess. But it was a mix of obviously losing his son. But I feel like he puts the blame of his son, of losing his son, on his son. Like, it's his son's fault. And like, you abandoned me in this family endeavor, you know? And like he didn't. If anything, he shipped him out. Like, you know, like it's really weird. Like he's not the son he had anymore. So because of that, he fucked up the dynamic they had. Yes. And he blames his kid for it. And I think it's because of he no longer trusts anybody. Like because of the brother, like that. So that scene with the stuff with the brother. I know you say you could take it or leave it, but I think it actually adds to it for the fact that. Because he gets so jaded with that thing of his brother that he's like, this guy just came up and he thought he was being very cautious. And to his defense, he was cautious. The guy just had this notebook, that this diary or journal of the guy's, of his actual brother, you know? Right. It's not his fault that the guy swindled him just in kind of like a really good way. So
and
like
he was open though. That's the thing, is that when his brother came, he was vulnerable.
Yeah, he was very vulnerable. Yeah, 100%.
More so for that.
Like, no, I 100% agree with you. That's what I'm trying to get at. Is the fact that like, it's after that, it's like the relationship with his son was scarred after that. He didn't even want to trust anybody. And now that his son is not the same son that he had, he definitely didn't want to trust anybody. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, went off to marry the sister of his villain of his
right.
Like that. Sunday.
Mary Sunday, yeah, the Sunday Ranch, exactly. That's right. That's like the core, the crux of all that, because it leads into the bandy tract angle and leads to really that church scene, the baptizing scene. It's fucking hilarious. I love it, and it's a very powerful performance for both of them. But you know, Eli seals his deal by the way he takes advantage of him in that scene. You know, because he'll never forget. Because years later, when they go back to 1927, he does not forget. He makes them
right.
Say that God is a superstition over and over again, just to pull on his
right.
He probably even like took. He could have, you know, drilled and the banding tract and all that, and probably, you know, dole out some money to get to the oil faster. But like he wanted to stick that knife in Eli. Instead, and then take it from drainage from the surrounding area of the land that he wanted to sell. Like, it was like a huge, like, fuck you to Eli. And
how he lied to him about his brother.
Yeah, he did it for spite.
Yep.
You know?
Now, I remember watching this movie when it first came out, and we had a theory of that the brother never existed, right?
Right.
That theory doesn't hold up, right? We all know that the brother, he had a twin brother.
Yeah, because he did actually go and tell him, like, Eli did tell his father, like, why did you trust, you know, Daniel? It was probably Paul that sent him here.
Yes.
Yeah, he does say that exactly. Very, very, very much so.
We missed it, though, the first time we saw this movie.
The first time we did, yeah. I remember talking about it, yeah.
We were like, what is going on? I thought they knew each other. And then when they meet over for the quail hunting they were pretending. Yeah, that was like, we just didn't understand. We were just, this movie was beyond us when we first saw it. It took a little maturity for us, I think, to understand this movie better.
It's a caption.
It's the captions too, probably. It was just a very subtle, interesting way, a twist on the whole twin thing. It was just an interesting angle. But ultimately, yeah, they were just brothers. But it was an interesting theory we had, though, about like him faking it or trying to get more money off him. And maybe that's where the mistrust initially came. But Daniel Plainview was never like, never thought that it was someone else. He knew that it was a different brother by the way he acts and everything. Ultimately, anyway, I think. I want to talk about the beginning, though. The opening that Ralph was talking about earlier about the first 15 minutes of him like prospecting alone, finding something. And then from there, you know, you can see the progression. Him hiring a few more people. One of those people has that son.
The man drags himself to town. With the broken
right.
Oh, yeah. So, I mean, that's true. Yeah,
he gets his stuff welded. He fixes himself up, gets his stuff checked out, and gets his money worth of what he found, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we see the bill of lading.
Right. I mean, all while his leg was broken. Like, he dragged himself everywhere. He probably looked like a damn fool.
Yeah.
Like, but that's just a bad determination. It's crazy. Like,
yes. I have something particular about that thing. He falls, right? A thing that happens all the time. Right, an accident. Right. 9 times out of 10, that man dies in there. 9 times out of 10, that fall kills you. That the wrong fall, you fall on your back instead of your leg, whatever it is. Right, you're incapacitated, you're paralyzed for life, you're dead down there. No one can hear you. Right, whatever. But he prides himself, and we know because of his actions throughout the movie, he doesn't say it, but he prides himself as a man who came up from, I'm not taking anything back from him. He did work very hard. He fucking focused. But like, he prides himself as a man who never needed such like the idea of luck. He never needed anyone else. Never like had to rely on the fates or anything like that. But he was the one in ten lucky bastard who didn't die from that fall.
Right.
You know, he himself is a victim to the same luck that a lot of people out there going to venture out in their own businesses
don't have
to deal with.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
A lot of them don't have. He was just lucky.
Yeah, well,
he'll never admit to that.
No,
that opening tells you that. That opening is about that. It's like it's contradiction. His own it demonstrates his hypocrisy of what he goes down in life later on.
Yeah,
and why everything that he managed to his empire doesn't mean anything. That's why his empire is meaningless, because of how he saw, you know, himself in that opening of the movie. That's how I feel. That's why that part is very important, I feel. And that's why it shows it that way. And then we see his coworker die, right? His from early on.
Right.
And he inherits HW.
Right? Adopts.
Adopts, kind of. I mean, back then.
Steals. Several,
I don't know what, I mean, steals.
I don't think we had social security numbers back then. Just, hey, that's my kid now.
Oh, right. It's my kid, right? Who else is going to, right? Exactly. Just, I don't know what, well, I don't know how life exactly
your number
works.
Is 000000001.
One, yeah. And that's interesting because I think his relationship with HW is built on a house of cards from the very get-go because of his need for something familiar, even though he never really seeks. You could tell he never had any ambitions to have a wife.
No,
or even
no, no, he never did.
I think he's asexual, honestly, and which led him to be not super popular with family-making wives or anything like that. So, like, or women, I mean. So, when he has this kid there on a house of cards, he does two things wrong. He uses the baby, or HW when he's a boy, to sell his business better. So
yeah.
That way, buy more land easier, probably a lot more easier. Pretend to be religious because everyone and their mother is religious back then.
Yeah.
And pretend to be religious as well as having this boy and saying some story about his mother died in childbirth that he doesn't even know. Maybe it's true, maybe not, but it doesn't matter. And so that's one thing. And the other one is that he never told HW. Obviously, maybe don't tell him when he's a boy, which is throughout most of the movie, but he never told him when they do the time skip to 1927 until he tells him only to leave his fucking house because he's a competitor now. Like, he tells him as a throw, to slap him, not to tell him because he needs to know. He tells him to slap him in the face, you know, to leave and stuff because he betrayed him. He feels betrayed because he's a competitor, not his ally or his, like, slave to whatever he wants. And that's why that whole thing falls apart from the beginning, really. And it falls apart for real, obviously. I mean, you know, more an emotional sake when the whole thing with the brother and him going deaf and sending him off. I mean, HW feels as betrayed, and he still doesn't take it in the same way that his quote-unquote father does. You know, it's, yeah, it's, that speaks volumes, the whole beginning of everything that's going to happen. What do you guys think of Eli?
Oh, man. Eli is... He's weak. He seems like he's weak.
Definitely. Compared to Daniel, yeah, probably.
Right, yeah. But even, like, his character, as far as, like, we only see Paul. Paul's like, hey, no, I want this money. I'm going to give you this information. I'm not stupid. I'm not going to just give it away. You know, all that stuff. And I think Paul had the good idea. Eli, not right. So much. And I like that. One of the ending things, like, where were you when Paul was sucking at the teat? Who nurtured you, Eli?
Yeah, he was the afterbirth.
That's right. What he
calls. Yeah. So you think Eli is more of just a weak character in his way?
I think so. I mean, Eli, you know, Eli's, I guess, more into his church and everything like that. But ultimately, I think Paul's the one that had the brains.
Eli's a leech, dude. He's a fucking... He's a sniveling rat bastard. I think he's Paul leaving left him to be the next alpha male in the dynamic of the family. The dad had no spine. The mom knew her place because that's her place back in the day. The everybody else, the sisters as well, and the two brothers had it. Probably Paul was the older one, so Paul is the one who had more say. He had his place, which was as alpha male of the house, the next in line. And he just had a stronger personality than his father did. And same thing with Eli. Just that Paul left, Eli took over, and Eli wanted his own things. You know, now he wants it his way. And he thinks he's all high and mighty, and he can try to take advantage of a situation. I feel like he tries to, like, imitate Paul and, like, I'm smart too, and I can do this also. But, he's clever. Don't get me wrong. Eli's clever. He's not as powerful. He has no power, really. And it's as much power as Daniel wants to give him, really. And, you know, Daniel goes along with his, like, okay, if it means I have to get you guys a church, it means I get you guys a church, you know, to get my ends meet. But he still holds it over to him. He never pays anything he tells him he's going to pay him. Because he deals with his dad, and the deal with his dad was X, Y, and Z. And he's like, I don't need to deal with you. Like, I don't need to deal with you because I dealt with your dad already. And your dad's the one who had the land, not you. So why do I have to ever deal with you again? As of right now, I'm just dealing with you till ends meet, till I need to not be here to not deal with you.
Yeah, but I mean, he does need Eli in a way that he never wants, of course, which is the face of his company, the face of his project of, you know, invading everyone's land and putting derricks up and drilling. And he needs to be good about it. That's why he says in that, not the opening, when he first talks, which is a great sales pitch when he gives that other, and when he actually starts talking in the movie. But I mean, the second one, when he's talking with the Sunday and other territories around, he's telling them, oh, we're going to build a school, we're going to bring bread. You know, he is just doing that so it could be easier for him to do it. So that way there's no, like, you know, whatever, like ground level, like actions against them where people like in the middle of the night are destroying derricks and shit like that. And that's why he needs Eli there. Eli's power relates to only that area that he's invading.
Oh yeah,
that's why Eli is a worthy villain, I guess, or worthy antagonist, because his power of religion, or his power with religion with the people, gives them a lot of clout. But the thing is that had Eli been a real true believer of the bullshit that he was spouting, he would never have minded a lot of the things that bothered him about what was happening with Plainview. And in turn, it led him to do some actions that sealed his fate, not to the death in that bowling alley, right, in that mansion, but also, like, sealed his fate with the money, too. He probably could have gotten it if he'd just gone through some lawyers or just regularly, or got his father to, like, sign something on it or whatever. You know, like, he wouldn't have minded. Like, he would have tried to save Plainview's soul, I guess, but, like, his... Everything around Eli is built on very similar actions that Daniel is built on. They're both the same person on opposite sides of this war or whatever. And, yeah, you know, they're both selfish. They're both egocentric.
Sure. I agree with you. The big difference is, like, Eli is a leech. This is the big difference, is that he cannot do it by himself. And he knows that. He needs Daniel. Without Daniel, he's nothing.
Well, without Daniel, he feels nothing. That's the thing. That's the difference. Because when we see him in 1927, he's there, like, in a way begging, right, for this land, for this land deal. And obviously what really sent him there is the Great Depression. Because the Great Depression is happening around that time.
Oh, of course.
And he is suffering like a many, many other, like most Americans at that time, successful or not. Now, Daniel Plainview is above that because he's made buff-fuck money. He is fuck-you money, Rich.
He's like a billionaire, a millionaire times.
Or the equivalent of a billionaire, and never has to worry about that kind of thing. So he goes to him, of course, with that in mind. That's why his son is going to Mexico. You know, when you think about it, he wants to start a company there.
Yeah, like, it was really weird to me the first time I watched this, and I was like, why is he going to Mexico? And I was like, this is 20s. Fucking, don't want to be in the United States either.
Hoover blankets, bro. Hoover blankets.
I guess, yeah.
Don't ask me, Luke, that if I ever have a blue... Okay, don't ask me.
You still use it. What are you talking about?
Shut up. So I think what the Great Depression coupled with what he feels he's not successful enough. But if you see how he looks and what he talks, like the subtle ways in that conversation before it goes to hell, he is describing a successful life as a minister. He has backing, has life. I mean, he has that fancy fucking cross and everything, the way he looks and suits up. Like, and he knows this, you know, potentially the Bandit family kind of has his full support. And they seem to have some great clout and money and leverage around in those areas. And it seems like the boy, the oldest boy of that family is heading off to some sort of like stardom in Hollywood and stuff like that. So, like, he has success. He probably has more, he definitely has more than enough, but not to him. It is not enough to him. So he wants to be on the level of Plainview, and that's his egocentric, selfish problem. But he is, and that's where his sniveling weaselness comes in. And obviously, he does have that, because in order to be friends with the Bandy family and have the control of whatever he has, he fucking has to do that. And the thing is that since he's the antagonist to our main character, he's always going to seem that way to us. He's always going to be the sniveling, you know, ineffective, loser, Eli, you know? And so when we see Plainview taking him down like five pegs in one sitting and then killing him, it feels very satisfying. I don't know. Do you guys feel satisfying? I felt satisfying.
I don't know. I mean, so it's funny because the first time I watched this movie, I didn't see Eli as like this sniveling, you know, leech. It was until like maybe like the second or third time that I was like, oh man, this guy's an asshole. Like, I literally thought he was just like this really good, like, I just want to be this preacher. I want to give the people a church. I want to give them like a voice of God, that kind of thing. And then I was like, okay, he seemed legit. Then I'm like, when he died at the end, I was like, oh, that's pretty rough, you know, didn't have to go that way. But upon watching it multiple times, I'm like, wow, this guy's a fucking asshole. I'm like, yeah, he had it coming. at least that's how I eventually developed my view into it, because like I said, first time I'm like, yeah, he's just, you know, wants to be that good old pastor type of person.
No, I never saw him like that.
I never did either. I mean, I kind of wish I did, just to have a comparison as a when I watch it again or something. But I never saw it that way. I saw it as pretty much the way Ralph described them. But I think a lot of that viewpoint, Ralph, comes from the fact that he's the antagonist to our much more successful and colder main character. And because of that, we see him even lesser than him.
Right.
But they're the same person. Eli's just less successful. I mean, thankfully, like, I'm glad there's no two Plainviews out there, I guess. One is more than enough, and we don't need that one either. But you know, this movie is filled with horrible people. Like, I mean, HW, who is, like I said, the most innocent, right? The innocent, he's a good person. Throughout, he's always a good person. He follows his dad. He's a boy, and then when he grows up, he's his own man, and he tries to be his own man. It's great.
Didn't he try to burn down the place though? With his
He did. But that comes from like, I mean, he's a
jealousy
boy,
or
no? I mean, some of that could be jealousy for sure. I mean, we haven't talked about that, I guess, but I think he. I mean, personally, I think he's acting out. He's just acting. I mean, that's how kids probably did it back then, that's how he does it. And he is extremely frustrated that he can't hear, can't communicate. And what's a boy to do? You know,
well, I blame him. It's not even that he can't even be understood. And that's the biggest problem, is that his dad won't even understand him or try to.
Yeah.
You know, so.
Yeah, I mean, I don't blame him. He's a boy.
No, I agree. Neither do I.
Yeah. That's how I feel about that anyway. But he's the one.
Attempted manslaughter. Just throwing it out there.
Attempted manslaughter.
I don't think they had that manslaughter as a law yet back then.
I have a question. Do you think Daniel gets in trouble for killing Eli, no?
He didn't get in trouble for killing the brother. The so-called half-brother.
No, the guy saw him kill. Yeah, exactly.
He didn't do time.
No, he didn't do time, no.
So, that brings up a good point, because honestly, like, at the last thing he says is, I'm finished.
Yeah.
And to me, it's like, well, is he finished in the sense, like, everything he's worked for is done because he's finished himself off? Or I'm finished with, like, I'm finally done with my arch nemesis rival. It's just like, what do you guys think?
Well, Roth, go first now.
Or Monetary Pursuits. Yeah.
I don't know. I think he's done. I think he's, I don't know. For me, the I'm finished is, I guess I take it more in a literal sense. He's just like, I'm finished. I'm done with this thing. this act, this whatever I did here. And I'm ready to continue my life, I guess, in the aspect of without Eli, you know, post Eli.
Shooting across the hall.
I'm going to sober up.
I don't really know. I don't really see the sobering up or anything like that. There's no moment of enlightenment. It's just more like a pinch off of his shoulders, you know, like something that was just there, a nuisance. And he's like, I'm done. I'm finished. But it's also like telling him, I'm done with this. Like, you should come clean this up.
Yeah, for me, it's a double meaning. One is more like what Raph was saying, is that I think Daniel Plainview himself is saying that, I'm done with tonight, I'm ready to go to bed. Like, that's the kind of feel I'm getting from that. Like, I'm done, I'm finished, you can clean up, Butler, you know, whoever
Butler
he is.
Guy?
Butler can't Bob. Wait. Butler Bob. Jeeves. The original Jeeves, that's him. Yeah, like, I think that's what he's saying. But in the context of the movie, since it ends right there, It means completely something else. Like, he is done. All business is done. All the old business is done. Every single, loose thread that the movie has left when they do the time skip to 1927 is now finished with Eli dead on the floor. And obviously, the promise of there will be blood with the title comes up at the very end with Eli's blood on the floor. And for some reason, you know, like, that's the title. You know, and that's when the title comes up in the movie, because we never get a title at all. We don't get an opening.
Yeah, like that. You also feel like the movie is like a double meaning on the "there will be blood," blood being oil.
Yes, of course.
Which, I mean, it could still be that. It's not the issue, but you're like, oh, I guess there was blood.
It's like a punchline, though. It's just funny.
It is like a punchline. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It works both ways. That's how I feel about it. But you asked a question, Luke. Do you have an answer?
I don't know. I was always confused by that. Like, I think it's like, I thought personally, like, he says, I'm finished. Like, I fucked up. Like, I'm finished. Like, this will be the end of me.
That's a good point of view. I never thought of that. No, I mean, I personally think he's so rich, he's fine. But I don't know. Maybe. I mean, he seems like, it seems kind of like he's done with life. Like, he's ready to die. He's done with everything. Done with his son, done with Eli. Who else is he going to, you know, instill his power over? Right? You could say that he's just finished like that. Like, I'm finished. I'm done. Like, checked out. You know, just die in some bed somewhere. Yeah. That could be.
Right on.
I think that's all I roughly got on this movie. And this is one of those other movies that's also been talked to death since it came out in 2008. But here it is, another entry. And I think we did really good on the entry as well. Anything else you guys want to add before we exit the show?
No, I don't have anything else.
Luke?
I'm pretty content. I can't think of anything else I want to talk about.
All right, cool. Then that is it for our show. You have been this whole time. Been listening to another movie podcast. You can follow me, Oscar, personally on Twitter and on Letterboxd over at Armin Filmmaker, which is filmmaker with ARMEN. Raph?
Yeah, you can follow me on Twitter at Don Rafael with underscore in between the Rafa and the L.
Way to emphasize that R.
Somebody had to.
Rafael.
Yeah. Don't be hate because I can roll my R's, mofos.
Yeah. Like, I can't. Okay, at Slothmaster Luke.
Nice. Now, Luke, for the first time since you've been returning since this year, you're going to pick the next movie.
4 months into it, boys.
And you've been avoiding this because we asked you the last time, but you were like, nah, I'm good.
Yes, you did.
But then again, you were also worried about leaving again, but yeah.
Yeah, that's true, yeah. So, but you're going to pick the next movie. So what are those three movies you're going to review?
Well, since I finally got accepted to the Sight and Sound List Marathon. We are going to watch Apocalypse Now.
Bro, you decided not to watch those other movies.
Insanity Later.
Insanity Later, yeah.
Right.
Apocalypse Now. And then, let me preface it a little bit before you say the other two. Since movie theaters are still very much closed and new movies are not coming out, at least not on a wide scale like we're used to on a weekly basis or anything like that. So instead of depending on streaming services to develop and make new releases, not that there isn't, there are, but just face it, guys, a lot of them are unknowns, or they're very much like a gamble as to whether or not they'd be good enough to talk or worthy enough to review, because we have no anticipation for them. You know, we know nothing. So we're going to instead focus on streaming sites. And Luke is doing Amazon, right, at this time?
Amazon Prime, yes.
And we're just, so he's going to pick two from there. And then next time Ryan Roth picks, he might pick Netflix or Hulu or whatever he wants. And then he'll pick movies from there only. And that's how we're going to play it until movie theaters open up again, guys. So, Luke, what are those two movies?
First one is going to be The Report. Hmm. And the second one is going to be Blow the Man Down, which are both Amazon originals, I believe. So
I don't think we can review porns on this. probably shouldn't. I don't think it'll go anywhere. What are we going to say? Oh, yeah, that clit was really pink? I mean, come on.
Very ballsy of them to put the camera right next to that crotch.
Yeah. That guy was extra shaved, more than I thought.
Right.
Okay.
Bleached asshole? I think so.
All right. So those are the three movies. Tune in next time. We come back every other Friday or every other weekend, I should say. So until then, I am Oscar.
Ralph. And Luke.
I knew that was going to happen. That's what happens when we can't see each other.
Wow.
You will not remember the last hour and a half of what you have just seen. You will forget the contents of this movie.